everything is in color, and I can feel the air. I can see it. I can see all the molecules. Can't you see it? I can see everything in color. Everything. You have to see the air. You can't believe it. I've never seen such infinite beauty in my life. It's like a curtain or a spider web. Can you see it? It's right here in front of me, right now. Watch. No. Good heavens. You know what went through me? It passed right through me.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 9th of February 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which, by the way, this week has just been updated to enable you to more easily go backwards and forwards through the longer clips, and also to get rid of those annoying Google ads, plus several other little features. The idea is, please do just feed them back to Nick, the developer, on whichever platform you download them from. He does listen, and every once in a while, I'll chibi him up. He will do a complete update, and apparently this new update on the app, he's been using ChatGTP to help him with his programming skills. So thank you so much, artificial intelligence, for providing this app to spread the truth rather than, well, I mean, it's up to you to decide. Don't believe us. You make up your own mind. But I certainly think it's sticking two fingers up, really, at this whole transhumanist agenda. So nice to see that ChatGTP has been unwittingly helping us down the road. So that's available from all good app stores, particularly Aurora is a good one. Although I'm not sure they've got the updated app yet, so you might have to go to Google Play Spoo to get that. So not Google, please, if you can manage it. But anyway, I'm Tony Gosling, still, and thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going off anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies, this religion called money, which isn't supposed to be even existing, but it's there, isn't it? With its temples like we've got here at Cabot Circus, where everyone comes and does their little Sunday worship now, crossing over the little bridge from the car park. Anyway, so helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution, or the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour Party activist Martin Summers, and also Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks. This week we'll be looking at planning corruption at the heart of Bristol with Joe here, and also listening to the opinions of Dr. David Halpin on King Charles' prostate operation, and also his alleged cancer, if he does indeed have cancer. What kind of cancer is it likely to be? What might they have found when they were doing the examination on him? Fascinating stuff from Dr. David Halpin, with his expert opinion. Also in part two, although we may have it in the first part actually, Dr. David Miller is vindicated in a judgment this week, to do with being sacked for alleged anti-Semitism, no longer anti-Semitism, according to the Employment Tribunal. So the only question, I suppose, down the line from now on is, what will the settlement be? What will he get for being wrongly dismissed from his job as a sociologist at Bristol University? So we'll be hearing from him. He'll hopefully be popping in. He's very busy. He's doing all sorts of little podcasts, and he's doing something in Bristol with Low Key over the weekend, already fully booked. But anyway, he'll be joining us, he says, at 6. At 7, Croatian-born former hedge fund manager and Russian West author Alex Craner will be joining us to discuss, along with Martin, the Tucker Carlson-Putin interview. So Iranian and Russian news cancelled in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then a few days later by Ofcom. In both cases, actually. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. And welcome again, Joe. You make it a bit of a habit of this.
Yes,
every few weeks. Lovely to have you here. Now, Planning Corruption in the Heart of Bristol is how I'm sort of headlined it. You and I have been talking about, we already have had a bit of a chat about this St. Mary La Porte planning development in the city centre. And before we look at the specific site, why would you, given all the things you could write about, why would you write about planning?
Well, I got drawn into the subject really through looking at, the start of 2022, and becoming aware of what the proposals that were planned for this site at the historic heart of Bristol, and just looking at that, basically three very large office blocks, made me feel that something was amiss.
Well, yeah, it's important to mention, isn't it? You've also got the old church tower dwarfed by these, which is...
It's St. Mary La Porte. So if we think about Bristol, this bit of land is where Bristol began over 1,000 years ago. It's the ancient crossroads that were first set out in late Saxon times.
So if you come over the Avon in central Bristol, just as, by the way, the bridge you're no longer allowed to drive over, you can only come in cycles, and I'm not even sure if taxis are allowed over there anymore.
Yeah.
But if you come over onto the north side, there's a little rise, and on the right-hand side is the entrance to the city's big park, really, Castle Park, alongside the edge of the river. And at the very top there, there's a crossroads. Three of the quarters of the crossroads are still built on, but there's one which is a bit back off the road, and it was built on, I think, after World War II when the whole area was redeveloped. So can you just take us a little bit through the history? I mean, you know, you can go back as far as you want, actually.
That bridge you're talking about going over there, That is pretty much the site of the original bridge that gives Bristol its name. So that the Saxon name was Brigstow, meaning the place by the bridge. It was that crossing of the Avon. That's why the settlement began there on that bit of high ground, originally surrounded by a loop of the River Frome, a tributary of the Avon, which was then diverted in the 13th century. But that was where Bristol started.
This is the place.
The place.
The place by the bridge is Bristol. This is the place.
And that area, Castle Park, you're saying, this site we're talking about is on the western edge of Castle Park. And Castle Park only exists because that very densely built-up area was all destroyed in 1940 in the Bristol Blitz.
But there was no castle there at that point, was there?
No, that had gone by the 17th century.
So this is Civil War.
But that area was the shopping and entertainment centre of Bristol, but made up of medieval streets, you know, half timbered buildings, but also cinemas, pubs,
and
shops,
pretty much
people living there.
I mean, after the war, pretty much the only thing remaining after 1940 Blitz, it was St. Mary La Porte Church. And I remember being told by one of the Polish visitors to Bristol working here, saying, well, this is so important that this is like it is, because it's a permanent reminder of World War II. It's a permanent reminder to everyone in the city what happened. And he's right, you know, you look at this old burnt out church, and of course the youngsters are saying, well, why is it like that? And mum and dad will start talking about
The tower remains. It's a 15th century church there, but that was, you know, the origins of Bristol are sort of shrouded in a certain amount of mystery. Historians argue over it, but that it's likely that was the site of the first church in Bristol. Following the Bristol Blitz, the tower remained, and then there was a big argument over what would happen to that part of the city after the war.
It's like you say, the place. It's the main heart of the city.
Yeah.
And so they took a while, didn't they? Wasn't it the 60s or 70s before they actually built on it at all?
Yeah, it took a long while. So, originally, the traders wanted to have the shopping district built again on that site. But the city fathers, the planners, and most importantly, the big retailers, the big national retailers, wanted to rebuild a new shopping area, which became Broadmead down the hill. So the whole area, it was a temporary car park, and there were lots of arguments about what would happen to it. Eventually, in the early 60s, they built these two very, very unpopular office buildings, the Norwich Union Building and a Bank of England house.
Right.
And then another building was built, Bank of England building was built next door.
It's
1970s.
It's an extraordinary place, isn't it? It's got almost like a kind of gun emplacement thing where the Bank of England trucks full of gold would go in and out. I guess they don't do that anymore. Of course they don't.
No, they've been... I mean, the buildings have been largely empty since the start of this century.
Yeah, a few parties have been going on in there. Some of them legal, some illegal.
There was a fire, as there always is.
And also, another thing is the business support unit of Lloyd's Bank, which is so very controversial for stealing people's farms off them and their businesses off them, very much like the HSBC scandal. But anyway, so the banks made the decision eventually, so it wasn't going to be for the people. Before, I mean, it's worth saying, isn't it, that some cities have been much more sympathetic than the 1960s planners here in Bristol were, and, you know, when rebuilding bombed cities after World War II, there were some very sympathetic rebuildings, like almost like old-fashioned Tudor buildings put back almost in their place.
Well, the Germans did that a lot.
Nothing like that here, these great concrete...
And it's a sort of classic trope in Bristol, is that the post-war planners did more damage than the Luftwaffe, because there was this huge program of, you know, road building, road widening, just knocking down, huge swathes of Georgian and Victorian buildings. You know, for good reasons sometimes. You know, the idea being that some of this was sort of crumbling, unsanitary housing, and we're going to try and create a better world for people, which was them building the estates further out in the city, but it meant there was a huge loss and a kind of, if you walk around the centre of Bristol now, there's a very jarring sense that the thing is a bit of a mess, but what remained of the old city is to the west of this site we're talking about. And you've got there a kind of dense concentration of Georgian and Victorian buildings, usually up to about four stories. You've got the ancient churches, because those crossroads we're talking about, the original crossroads, marked out each quarter was a different parish, and you've still got the spires and the towers of the various churches around that site.
Okay, so you've got, in the 1960s, these buildings are put up where they're used for a few couple of decades, slowly fall into disrepair. The Bank of England, the Norwich Union, all kind of derelict and empty for decades now. And there were proposals, weren't there, to have a much more sympathetic than these towering office blocks. I saw one, I think it was from Ferguson Mann, George Ferguson's, the former mayor's architecture firm, which was much lower. I mean,
they were controversial because they sort of bit into the park, and you then had a group forming to oppose that because they felt it was taking too much
prime real estate. The one thing they don't want to do, of course, is just to demolish them and return it to park, because this is incredibly valuable land.
Yes.
There's lots and lots of spondoolies.
Yeah. And to get back to the original point of why talk about planning? Planning can be very dry, dry and technical, and a lot of people will kind of groan when the subject comes up. But it ties, when you've got a place like this, you're tying into the history of the place, the identity of the city. It's also a very political subject, and it's also about power, as you say. It's money and power.
So Marvin Rees, when he's come along, didn't really have such an architectural eye as the previous mayor. And this new development, which is literally about to start, getting shovels into the ground, any time now. Marvin Rees, what about his role?
So Marvin Rees came in 2016, became mayor. And in his first State of the City address, he talked about... wanting to see the skyline grow, was his words. because tall buildings mean energy and ambition. Those were his words.
Money. Actually, so, that's what they mean, money. Extra floors means extra money.
It's an idea. I mean, he came in with a very, as you said, his predecessor, George Ferguson, was an architect and had and was part of the, there was a very big movement in the 60s and 70s covered in a book called The Fight for Bristol, where you had all these architects and amenity groups who were seeing what the planners are doing to the city and gathered together, and there was a big kind of fight back against
I remember chatting to George about a massive battle over an enormous hotel they wanted to build on the side of the side of the Avon Gorge.
And they were doing things like the view of it. They were going to concrete in part of the harbour.
That's right, fill it all in with concrete and sell it off at every square acre or whatever.
So there were all these kind of destructive ideas, but Marvin Rees came in 2016 with a sort of very different vision of what a city was.
You know what his
ambitious city was.
His buzzword was cranes on the horizon.
Right, and that's all we've had. There are a lot of cranes on the horizon. So part of my interest in digging into what happened around this planning application was. As I went into it, it was increasingly seeing how pulling up the bonnet and looking at the mechanics of how this mayoral regime was trying to control planning, basically.
Well, I think that will come out as we discuss through this. But what about this company, Federated Hermes, that's put forward this application? It's not taking over the whole of the park, is it? It's say something about, isn't it, about an eighth or a quarter of the park on that corner by the crossroads?
Yeah. It's essentially the same area as the three buildings that are there now. So when Marvin Rees came in, his one of the first things he did was to begin a review of the local development plan. So all planning applications, what the planning department does is they assess them against the local development plan and the national planning policy framework. Those two things, and so it's your policies and your local plan that shape.
Well, it should do.
So that's the idea anyway.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's a tug of war between the developers
and
the plan.
So that's supposed to be the democratic control, because all this is a local plan is ultimately voted through by the council, full council, by the councillors. So that's what's supposed to control development. But what Rees, the person Rees got in to oversee this whole process was a woman called Nicola Beach, who was a new councillor, new Labour councillor, and she had come, as she took that role, she came into his cabinet in 2017, took over the role for spatial planning, and was given the task of reviewing the local plan. She had come from a PR and lobbying company called JBP, who have offices in Bristol, though they're national, and they work for developers in the planning process, so she was, at that point she was literally working for them, trying to get a 24-story tower built on Cardiff waterfront, which didn't happen after a big public backlash, but that's the person he got in to oversee this review of the local plan.
This is about money, Joe, isn't it? Let's just be frank. Cardiff waterfront, right in the very centre of Cardiff, a massive building there. You know, the rents on something like that, the prestige involved, the money involved is enormous.
Yes. Yeah.
So it may cost them a few grand or tens of grand to get their planning permission, but at the end of the day, you've got then a massive rental income into the indefinite future from it. Yeah. That's why this is all so important.
But when you say corruption, what I've been writing about isn't about cash in brown envelopes so much, but about how you manipulate the system, how you get the right people in place. And how you manipulate the system.
You trip up the other team in the tug of war when you've got councillors and planning officers pulling in one direction, that is to say the local plan, this is what we want to do, this is what's good for local people, and the developers pulling back the other way.
Yes.
You can trip up a few people on the opposite side. You win the tug of war.
Yes. And who are the who's working for who. If you've got someone in there who's come directly from that background of working for developers in the planning system, are they necessarily working for the public good?
No, not necessarily. No. So, who are these people federated?
The first thing they did with this review of the local plan was to put a call out to developers and say, "Tell us which sites in the city you're interested in." Right. That was in 2017. And Federated Hermes then got in touch with the council and said, "We rather like this site at St Mary Le Port." Federated Hermes are a US-based global investment manager, and they currently manage assets of over $700 billion. So they're huge. They're the biggest shareholders of BlackRock and the Vanguard Group. They work alongside the BT pension scheme. And they've done a lot of big commercial developments all over the UK in sort of the last 10 to 20 years, including, huge business parks. There's one at Silverstone Park by the racetrack. There's one in Oxfordshire. They've done massive office Leeds, the biggest ever office scheme in Leeds. Big office schemes in Birmingham, Manchester.
So these
Belfast.
People are not interested really in taking old buildings, refurbishing them, that sort of thing. What they want really is to build new, build big, and to get to rake it in afterwards.
Yeah. To build on a big scale. I mean, and so there are questions around why, there's a discussion obviously going on at that early point about this site. Why is the council? It had been a difficult site to develop. There are schemes that had come through and not worked out. But the idea that you're encouraging or you're inviting a developer that builds enormous commercial schemes into the historic heart of the city seems rather odd to start with, anyway.
To be fair, you've got there is with the Norwich Union and the Bank of England, two hideously, messy buildings. One where there's, it looks like it's almost a squatted version of Lloyd's Bank, which is very tatty buildings all around it with just one floor entrance, which is all quite clean and seems to have cleaners coming into it. But the rest of it is falling. Rest of the buildings are falling down around it. There is obviously pressure on city fathers, on everybody really, to say, well, let's just sort this site out, please.
Yeah. But it's about, and the catchphrase of Rees's mayoralty has been getting stuff done, isn't it? You could see this just as an example of getting stuff done. But there's a balance to be struck between just getting stuff done and doing things that aren't going to wreck the city.
Martin, I wonder if you could chip in here. We were told, weren't we, when they went over to the mayor system, this was a coalition government Cameron Clegg thing, the city deal. We were told that this was actually what it was about, getting things done, because there was too much political infighting going on, and they wanted things to move.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember that era, as you probably do. The control of the council was constantly flicking between the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party. Because they didn't have all-out elections, there were elections every year in some wards, you could never be sure who would be running the city in the next year. So there was a constant bickering going on about everything. And, of course, in those circumstances, hardly anything got decided. So, of course, the idea of having a mayor was that you'd have one person in charge, the go-to person who would make the decisions, and then decisions would be made. And I think when we have the referendum to have a mayor, that of course the referendums to have and not to have a mayor had a very minimal turnout, nothing like 50% of the electorate, but the system was switched. And of course it was originally conceived by the Tory government as exactly that. It was going to actually create a back of a fag packet stuff. What do they do in the United States? oh, they have elected mayors. And of course, George Ferguson had been agitating this for many years. So he wanted to be a mayor, and he'd agitated for Bristol to have a mayor. And then he won he got what he wanted, and then he became the first mayor. And then, of course, Marvin Rees, the Labour Party, then reconfigured what it was doing and said, well, we'll have mayors, because Marvin was the candidate against George Ferguson, but he lost.
But I think, to a large extent, he managed to ride to power on the back of Jeremy Corbyn nationally, who was quite popular at the time.
You mean Marvin?
Yeah.
Well, Marvin was elected before Corbyn became the leader, and he became the mayor before Corbyn became the leader, so that wasn't the case in that sense.
He was 2015. Corbyn came in 2015, didn't he?
Yeah, it was about the same time. I can't remember the exact time.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I can remember thinking.
Well, what was interesting about
what you've got is you've got an actual opposition for a change with certain Miliband characters out of the way, and Corbyn suddenly. I mean, he was doing meetings around the country.
But Corbyn got people out, and he got people involved. Yeah. If you look at the turnout it almost doubled the turnout of people who voted in the mayoral election 2012 to 2016.
Yeah.
It's almost doubled.
Yeah.
So I think that is the Corbyn influence.
Well, and of course, what Marvin did at the time, when Corbyn was, when there was all the rows in the Labour Party about whether Corbyn was going to be the leader, he ostentatiously did not take sides. Whereas all the Labour MPs ostentatiously opposed Corbyn. They didn't want Corbyn. Yeah. They made that absolutely clear.
Well, I think he realised that
Marvin took the view that I'm the mayor of Bristol. That's my role. I'm not going to take sides for or against Corbyn.
He owed his
job
to
Corbyn.
Actually,
I thought that was quite a smart move at the time by him. But of course, subsequently, you've got all the problems we know about having just one person and a clique around.
Well, the question is,
decisions.
Getting things done for who? This is the question, Joe, isn't it? Really, if you're going to get, we've got someone who can get things done, but who's lobbying them the hardest? The voters or private developers, private individuals, and speculators?
Yes, and I mean, it should be pointed out that there's a legal firewall between the executive of a local authority. So in Bristol, that's the mayor and his cabinet. And planning, which is supposed to be planning decisions in law are meant to be entirely separate from the executive. So again, this is what I'm looking into is how, despite that, they've tried to impose as much influence over planning as they can within that framework.
Okay, so we've got these applications coming in, various sites saying, oh, would anyone like to build in Bristol? We want cranes on our horizon.
And so what they do next to is Federated Homes buy up the buildings, the three buildings, the leaseholds. So Bristol City Council own the freehold of that land, those buildings. But Federated Homes, between 2018 and 2020, buy up the three leaseholds.
Do you happen to know how long those leases are, do you?
Oh, they're about 1,000 years.
Oh, right.
So,
okay.
You know, so that's 999 years, something
a
like
bit
that.
Of a long time. I mean, it's not almost like you may as well not bother having the freehold if you're giving leases like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have happened in the 60s, I imagine, when these people at the Bank of England had a little bit of leverage, and Norwich Union did, saying, look, we will build there, but only if you give us a 1,000-year lease. What about the chit-chat that was going on behind the scenes? Because I know some of that has come out through Freedom of Information requests and through newspaper articles and things. Talking, weren't they, the developers and the council, quite a lot?
Well, before a planning application goes in, is submitted, There's a period of pre-application correspondence between the applicant and the planning department, where the applicant is saying, here's our proposal, and then the council, as the local planning authority, are saying, are giving their feedback basically, and saying this complies with our policies, this doesn't comply with our policies. But I got all the pre-application correspondence for this application, and in it you can see that for 6 months, and that's going between the planning department and also this other department in the council called City Design, who are the placemaking specialists. So they're the officers who are.
So which side of the firewall are they though?
Well, they're not making decisions. It's the planning department who are making the decisions, but these internal specialists, they are feeding into the process. They're feeding, so that they're responding to the proposals and they are recommending to the planning department about what the response should be. So that's this is heritage specialists, engineering specialists, placemaking specialists.
Okay, so the planning side of the firewall, rather than the mayor and the executive side.
Oh yes, yeah. They're not political. They're officers in the council, and you can see, you can look at this, and for 6 months they're going back and forwards, and the planning department and city design are saying, this is just too big. The height, the scale, the massing of these proposals.
Yeah, a lot of these people will probably have been put in place under George Ferguson or previously, so they've been there for a while.
Oh, a lot officers, of them have been there for years and years, yeah. But they're saying this is going to overwhelm the old city. What remains of the old city.
Yeah.
They're going to tower over it. It's commercial scale, so 8 and 9 stories. That's much bigger than residential. You know, because the floor heights are much higher. So that if you look at the pictures, hopefully you'll put some pictures up on the website.
Yeah, there's later. Now, by the way. Well, thisweek.org.uk if you want to have a look,
have
folks.
A look at them.
And you can see how these buildings dwarf the church tower,
and it's
example.
And what remains of the rest of the old city, and blocking views of the spires and the church towers that are there. It's not only their size was being criticised, but it was the sort of jarring nature of their design, and they're all each block is designed in a sort of totally different way to the other one. You've got one that's a terracotta colour, which is supposed to reference Redcliffe, which is the area over the river with its sort of red brick warehouses. But it's in a totally different, conservation area.
Redcliffe was a stone, wasn't it, that they would mine to make glass with? And that was quite a famous thing that happened over there.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it has a distinct kind of character, which is totally different from the old city. For all these reasons, they're saying, we can't recommend this for approval. We can't.
So basically you're saying to Federated Hermes, don't waste your time, this won't get through planning.
Yes.
Come up with something a bit like this or a bit like that,
and you may
get it.
Yeah, yeah. You can also see in other freedom, because there were freedom of information requests that I didn't put in, that other people had put in. This is all available at whatdotheyknow.com. And you can also see minutes from meetings that were going on, obviously quite fairly fraught meetings, where you've got the head of planning, Gary Collins, there, repeating that line, saying this just isn't acceptable. We're not going to be able to recommend this, and the developer, they're refusing to budge. And then you've got you can see the involvement of this guy Stephen Peacock, who I spoke about on another program, who's now the chief executive of the council. Then he was the executive director for growth and regeneration. And he came in 2019 with a background in, he'd worked for BP and he'd worked in mobile phone technology and he'd worked for the Southwest Regional Development Agency. But he comes into the council in 2019. He's getting increasingly involved. But what he'd also been doing at this time was doing he'd just undertaken a review of planning. This involved setting up regular meetings called Driving Development, which were with the mayor's office, in particular the head of the mayor's office and his policy advisors.
Names for them?
Kevin Slocum, the head of the mayor's office. So these were probably monthly meetings, and you can see in this review that they've written up that it's about working out which developments going on in the city are called mayoral priorities, and how best to get them through as sort of as fast and as painlessly as possible through the system.
Now, you talked about a firewall. Surely, I mean, the mayor should be, you know, verbally encouraging, but there's not really anything he can do behind the scenes. It's all down to the planners, isn't it?
That's what the system's supposed to be, yeah. It's supposed to be a sort of a fair and transparent system, and it's not supposed to involve the executive, the mayor. So that's going on.
So those meetings are all minuted and everything? They're official?
No. There are no minutes for those meetings, no.
What?
No, because in these Freedom of Information requests, the person who's made the request is asking for the minutes, and they come back with some sort of excuse that all this information is going to be made public soon, so we don't have to give you minutes. So that's going on. The application is then submitted in May 2021. And what you can see happening after that, the developer then gets in touch with Nicola Beach, who's this councillor who had worked for this PR company. And she's one of a key point of contact. So again, it's going through a political route, even after the application's been submitted. This is not going to the planning committee. And you can see the developer responding to an article in the Bristol Post, which had a sort of uncomplimentary headline about the proposals. And they're saying, in light of this, would it be possible to have a meeting with Marvin? She forwards that to the mayor's office, and the response that comes back is that Marvin doesn't need to see him now, but they can have a meeting with Kevin and Stephen Peacock. So that's then going on that summer of 2021. Nicola Beach is also having unminuted meetings with the developer. You can see that. And then at some point in August, Meanwhile, Historic England have put in a very punchy objection to the application. Objections from all the kind of conservation groups and amenity groups in Bristol. But at some point that summer, they clearly decide that they've accepted the developer's not going to budge. And they're going to the offices are going to recommend it. The planning managers are going to recommend it for approval.
What about the civic society? They've been involved for decades in this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, so they objected quite strongly. I mean, there were things that people liked about this proposal, that particularly around the sort of ground floor, and it opens up. A kind of permeability through to the park that doesn't exist at the moment, but again, it's just the scale of them, the height, the scale, the massing of these big office blocks would overwhelm the old city, is what they're saying. The civics, when it was ultimately approved, the civic society did in early 2022 request a call-in to the government. Because that's sort of the appeal that you can make. It's for the Secretary of State to have a look at it, which they did. I mean, I think from what I understand, that there was quite a lot of internal, a big tussle, because the civic society have been much less forthright during this period of. Of development that's been going on during Marvin Rees's regime than they were, say, back in the 70s. But they were sort of pushed by various people, I think George Ferguson being one of them, to ask the government to look at it. But ultimately, they said, no, we're going to leave this to the local planning authority to sort out.
I'm sure there are some people looking at this, Joe, saying actually it's better that something like this happens than nothing happens, and that's the alternative, to leave this for another decade or more as this kind of monstrosity with graffiti all over it, right in the heart of the city.
Yeah, and that's what some of the councillors said when they were voting on it, when it ultimately came. I personally would say you shouldn't take that attitude with a site like this. You know, this is the most historic part of the city. It's a place with this tragic history, and if you take a shrug your shoulders attitude, and say that basically the policies and the local development plan don't mean anything, then that's a total free for all.
Well, and also, yeah, you know, it's very clear that Federated Hermes are winning, have won. They what's happened is not only have they got what they wanted, but they've also changed the system in Bristol, really, by getting there have been a bit big changes in personnel planning, haven't there? People have been gotten out of the way and new people brought in.
Well, yes, so ultimately, I mean, yeah, I was talking about this this review of planning that they'd had and working out how to streamline the system and increase the control of the mayor's office, and that kind of came to real fruition at the end of 2022, when they got rid of, they just disbanded City Design, the sort of awkward group of specialists within the council, and brought them under the control of a new role, a new chief planner role, and the new chief planner came into their role in 2023. It's a woman called Simone Wilding, who is a former colleague of Stephen Peacock's, who's now the chief executive. They work together at the South West Regional Development Agency. And just to go back a second to how it was got through the committee of councillors who voted it through. I mean, it was quite a tight vote. It was 5-3. You have a cross-party committee of councillors that vote on major schemes or particularly controversial schemes. Another thing I look at in this piece is how the report was written, because you have a report that the case officer, one of the planning managers, writes that goes to the committee, and in that report, and this report was written by a chap called Peter Westbury, who'd been in Bristol's planning department a long time, but became a manager on major schemes in 2016, about 5 months after Marvin Rees came into office. He is the chair of trustees at the church that Mayor Marvin Rees attends, and his report deliberately excluded City Design. So we talked about City Design, these internal specialists, that they, until they were disbanded, were an integral part of the planning process, their input. If you look at officer reports for schemes before this and after it, applications, you'll see City Design quoted or their views and comments outlined, summarised by the case officer. And they were just left out of this report. You know, which is pretty extraordinary. You know, this is a major scheme at the historic heart of the city, and they were just excluded. In fact, there's one bit that says City Design comments are summarised in key section C. You go to key section C, and there's no mention of City Design there at all. So that's the kind of thing which is deliberately misleading the councillors who voted on it, because you're not providing them with the information that you say you're providing them.
Well, one of the objections, if I can just bring this in, at the time of that decision, was the number of trees that were going to come down. And in fact, there was an enormous amount of lobbying from people in the city saying, look, no, 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 just readjust your footprints of your buildings to fit around the existing trees. Why don't you do that? There's plenty of space there. But no, they're going to be demolishing quite a lot of trees, aren't they? That, you know, looks like.
To be fair, they didn't shift one building to save some mature trees on Wine Street.
But Fee Hance, who's the Green councillor on that committee, I seem to remember she got a lot of criticism afterwards, saying, "Well, look, why on earth didn't you just stick your hand up? It would have been a 4-4 vote, and maybe they wouldn't have got this." But you've gone along with it.
Well, she's a Green. So the councillors that voted for it were the rather peculiar Conservative chair, Richard Eddy. Another Conservative councillor who actually just recently discovered is a Freemason, this isn't necessarily connected, but he actually has a podcast where he talks to fellow Freemasons. But anyway, that's just sort of
aside. Who's that?
John Geeter. He's a councillor for Avonmouth and Lawrence Weston,
which is kind of Bristol Port.
Yeah, and he's on the board of Bristol Port as well, actually.
Right, which has got the Merchant Venturers on there too, Skellet and the rest of them.
And then you had two Labour councillors. You know, with this mayoral pressure, basically you generally get the Labour councillors will always vote for a mayoral priority scheme, even though there's supposed to be no political. Yeah, councillors are supposed to judge these applications on planning policy criteria alone. There's supposed to be no political element.
And I've heard of cases where councillors, if they're speaking on in the press and make even the smallest comment which is negative about a planning application, will get excluded from the committee, so they're not allowed to be sitting on the committee in some cases. It's very, very sensitive.
So you had two of the Labour's vote, and then you had one who abstained. And it looked to me like she really didn't like it at all, and she would like to have voted against it, but I think in the end she settled with abstaining. I can't remember her name.
Yeah.
And then you had this Green councillor, Fee Hance, which was a surprising one, but she was saying, and this is where you have the influence of the officers in the meeting, who are basically selling their recommendation, and she's sitting there saying, I don't like this. I don't like this. This proposal. It's far too big. But our policies mean that we can't vote against it.
So the planning officers were recommending that it was accepted, not refused.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They're recommending the councillors to approve
it. And the councillor is.
And they're saying. They're saying our policies support this application.
And the council's saying this is terrible, but
this is the same guy, this is Gary Collins, who's there, he's there with Peter Westbury. And you can see he looks deeply uncomfortable in the meeting, because for 6 months prior to this, until the application was submitted, he'd been in those meetings arguing with the developer, saying the exact opposite. He'd been saying that this is too big, this is not something that we can recommend for approval.
So he's under heavy manners. From whom?
Well, I think it's quite evident that there's a lot of pressure on him from the mayor's office, from Stephen Peacock. And minutes after the vote goes through, you can see in the emails, he excitedly emails Slocum Peacock saying it's passed. And Peacock replies, fantastic, great work, well done. And he's, Gary Collins left not that long after this, but has now turned up at Bath and North East Somerset. So he's now the interim head of planning at Bath, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. A little bit concerned.
I mean, some people listening will say, what's the point of all of this? This is a slam dunk. It's finished. It's done with. Why You've actually pretty much embarked on most of this research and writing, Joe, and the article, by the way, is linked even right now on our show page at thisweek.org.uk after the decision's been made. I mean, you know, what's the point of trying to revisit it?
I think it's important just to try and see how things are working. There's nothing that's going to stop this development now.
Apart from direct action.
Chaining yourself to the railings. But I was sort of writing it for, you know, someone in 30 years, you know, maybe even someone who hasn't been born, who's walking through what's left of Bristol's old city and comes across these vast, jarring office blocks and wonders what the hell's happened here. And then, you know, they can have a look and see. But it's also there's a bigger question of, you know, it's also the question that's been it was in my head a long time and got me thinking is just the simple sense of why are we surrounded by so many ugly buildings in this country.
Well, the other end of Castle Park, there's another massive ugly building, isn't there?
Well, you're talking about Castle Park View, which is this 26-storey, now the 26-storey residential.
Built on the old ambulance station.
Yes, that was the marker. That was the sort of statement that said, we're building up, we're changing
the scale. Well, it's almost like a recce, you know, to see what we can get away with.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to do that.
Stake in the ground.
Yeah. So anyway, what about Design West and how? Who are they and how did they get
there? This is another. It's a sort of another element of how of seeing how the broad sort of the wider system, the wider development system is finessed. You know, if you're going to put it in its nicest sense. So Design West are architecture and placemaking consultancy based on Bristol's Harbourside, and they offer a design review panel service, which so all big schemes in Bristol at the pre-application stage, the proposals go in front of a panel of sort of architects, development professionals. From Design West, who assess it and feedback, and this happened for Sir Mary Laporte, and as I was saying, in the case officer report, they excluded the council's internal specialist, City Design, but what they did instead was lean very heavily on the feedback that had come from Design West, this external consultancy.
So they've outsourced that in a way. What they've done is they said, well, we don't like the decisions coming out of our internal civil servants. What we're going to do is we'll outsource it to some private company.
Yes. So and this is supposed, I mean, Design West call themselves an independent placemaking service, and so then I started looking into how independent are they and who were the people on this panel who gave a really positive and you know fulsome response. They had they looked at it twice. The first one, you know, it's very, very positive. The heights are all fine. They had a few suggestions. The second one, was all thumbs up. And I had a look at who was on that panel. It was chaired by a guy called Charles Wilson, who chairs the whole of the Design West panel service, and he was also the chair of something called the Strategic Advisory Group for the Bristol Beacon refurbishment, which has been a big controversy in Bristol.
A massive overspend, yeah.
Yeah, the huge overspend, the council's spend going from 10 million to 84 million. But he was actually chairing this group for the Bristol Music Trust, who are the charity that run the Bristol Beacon, that was supposed to be overseeing the build as it went along. So someone, you know, a sort of a Bristol establishment person who's tied into, who's tied into the council and what's going on with development in the city. You had other people. It was a panel of five that looked at the summary report proposal. You also had a director from Arup, who at that moment had just been overseeing Arup's strategic partnership with Bristol City Council, which was directly with Stephen Peacock, which basically is an arrangement that they made with Arup and a couple of other firms, where they would be the consultants for infrastructure projects in Bristol.
Right, so all this stuff finds its way into the case officer report, which is the, you know, in the application itself.
Yes,
and for
which is going to the council
for the meeting with where she's going to make the decision.
And you had two of the other panel members giving this feedback. Their companies were at that point working on other projects. One of them actually in Bristol with the architects. For Samaria Port, and the architects Field and Clegg Bradley Studios have very direct links with Design West. They're one of their founders, Peter Clegg, is on the review panel service. He was actually chair of another panel service called Creating Excellence, based in Bath, that merged with Design West. Well, merged to form Design West.
Let's just pull this apart a little bit, because it seems to me what's happened is there's resistance to this when it's initially put forward. Slowly but surely, the resistance is sidelined, got written out, and various friends of friends are mustered and excuses found to put their views into the case officer report. But this isn't really being done by the planning officer, is it? You know, this is being done by the mayor's office. This is being done by the various associations of developers in the city. I mean, that's one side of things, but the other side, and in fact, I think we this is where we first spoke to you about this a while ago, and that's this thing called the Friends of Castle Park.
Yes,
because
sure.
At the other side of all of this, we've got to be thinking about the you know, the one of the important parts of the application is what do the local people think. What
yes
do they
the
think?
Community engagement, which is, you know, which is supposed to be central to the developer's proposal.
Now, you actually put together an article about this, didn't you? And found that the people you were writing it for didn't want to publish it.
Well, okay, so
what happened there?
Well,
because this is only a tiny part of all this.
Yeah, this was one of the things that first got me just thinking. This is odd. This is sort of a strange setup. This community group, Friends of Castle Park, kept appearing in the local press, fully supportive of the development, but it turned out that they were this was a Facebook group, and that when these media reports said Friends of Castle Park, what they were referring to was, basically one guy who'd set up this Facebook group, who lived locally, who'd moved to Bristol in 2018.
Because the only thing is, it's important, I think, to understand that community engagement is part of the legal process. You have to find out, you know, what do the local people think? This is an important thing to have in there. So who is this guy?
Well, he'd actually been a councillor in Mid-Bedfordshire, and he'd been on the planning committee of this town council, Shefford in Mid-Bedfordshire. So someone who was very familiar with the planning process. He attended a meeting at the council in 2018, an area committee. So these are committees of councillors who hand out community infrastructure levy, which is funds from developers that can then go out to for infrastructure and projects around the city, and you can see in the minutes of that meeting that there was a suggestion that a Friends of group should be started for Castle Park. And Councillor Nicola Beach was at that meeting, and I think it's quite likely that she made that suggestion. And this was actually the same month that Federated Hermes bought the first leaseholds to the buildings. This is September 2018. And then the following week, this Facebook group starts up. And then once, a couple of years on, once it gets into the sort of the planning application process, the Friends of Castle Park are right at the centre of the developer's so-called community engagement process. There's a couple of public meetings, online meetings. Friends of Castle Park are first on the list of all the local stakeholders that they've been talking to. But you know, all the time, this is just one bloke, and you've got a thousand members on this Facebook group who aren't being consulted at all, and he then submitted misleading statements to the committee around the support among this membership, which is Facebook membership, because there were no, I mean, this group never had any meeting, you know, real meetings. It never had an AGM, never had a officers, you know, people.
But you say there's no brown envelopes involved here, but surely he's on a gravy train here somehow.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I've got no evidence that he wants to see that site sort of developed at any cost, I think.
We also saw, didn't we, Burgess Salmon. I sent something to you a week ago or so. The Burgess Salmon, who seemed to have suddenly taken an interest in Castle Park, their staff given time off to go around picking up litter, this sort of thing.
Well, it's, I think if you're, there's a network of people who are in the sort of loop of the Bristol establishment, and if you're in that, then these same kind of names, these same organisations pop up everywhere. But another thing with this community engagement, the PR company that the developer hired to run their community engagement process was a consultancy called Marengo Communications. And another one of these links is that the director of Marengo Communications is a former colleague of Nicola Beach's, the councillor, who's been at the centre of the whole process. I was writing an article for the Bristol Cable about the role of Friends of Castle Park, and that they weren't who they said they were. And it should be pointed out that two of the Labour councillors who voted to approve it in the meeting cited Friends of Castle Park, saying, because Friends of Castle Park support this application, I feel I can vote to approve it. You know, so this is having a real-world impact. I was writing the piece, and then the editor told me that someone had contacted a director of the paper to tell them that I'd been harassing this chap, this Friends of Castle guy, which I absolutely hadn't been. Had actually had very few communications with him. But when I asked who was made this suggestion, the answer that came back was Nicola Beach, who seems to be at the centre of everything.
Amazing. So, in a nutshell, what's the real way that planning works in Bristol now? Because the things do seem to have changed. Personnel have been moved out, new people, new groups.
Well, the mayoral system ends in May, so we've only got three months of that. And it'll be interesting to see what happens after that. I mean, this new chief planner role is in place. And and Stephen Peacock, who's been a key central figure in all this, he is still there until the at least the end of this year.
So do you think, so, is it, I mean, there's another subtext here, and that is the idea is that this massive development right for the city centre, which is so obnoxious, the idea is to get it done whilst the mayor system is still there, because it may well not get through once the mayor's out of the way and the committee system is back in place again.
Yeah, I mean, it went through, I mean, planning permission was granted in September 2022. So they've had permission for well over a year now. But it spans, the whole process really, you know, almost spans the whole of that Marvin Rees's period as mayor. And I would recommend, I've written two, I've written a very, very long version of this, which goes into
Actually, it's a book, isn't it?
It was 40,000 words, so it pretty much is
just about St Mary's.
So if you can handle that, then I recommend it's on my Substack. Or there's a shorter version where I've tried to be a bit more concise.
Is it fair to ask you who you think the villain of this piece is? Because it almost seems like it's not even the mayor. He's stepping back. It's people like Slocum behind the scenes who seem to be the ones who are actually doing the deal. The mayor, his role seems to be someone who goes and stands in front of microphones and says things, but he doesn't really seem to be at the heart of this at all.
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, because obviously in all the stuff that I've seen, the internal emails, the freedom of information requests, he is deliberately kept at a remove from that. But it's, you know, those driving development meetings I was talking about, that's his head of the office, it's his policy advisors, yeah. You know. So it's clearly that they're driving his agenda.
I suppose what I'm saying, a sort of clique seems to be developing. People will know each other and who will make sure that these things are forced through, come hell or high water.
Yeah, and looking at this, it's not just the political structure, but it's you know, as I've tried to draw out, it's also this wider network of development professionals who are a sort of a kind of remote cast of people who are working out their own version of the city.
Yeah, I mean, I've met some of them from Places for People who've owned this massive slice of land in St Paul's, which was demolished, and they're just sitting on it, land banking it, waiting for the value to go up to put and maybe for the regime to change, where they can get what they want. That is to say, taller, higher buildings, higher density buildings, and this sort of thing. Anyway, Joe, just remind us of your Substack where people can check this out. Download and read your book if they really want to, yeah, about this, or the shorter version.
Yes, joebanks.substack.com.
And you've got another website too, haven't you, with some of your old advice articles and things like that on?
Yeah, joe-banks.com.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. I think it's just amazing the way that, you know, rather than just by, I mean, it's a similar sort of journalism as I feel, which is where you're told, no, go away, you're not going to publish this. You come back with something which is rather more powerful. Anyway, thanks, Joe. And we'll have a quick listen to a lady. I say it's quite quick, it's about 3 minutes, and get Martin to comment on this, because there was a most incredible interview yesterday on BBC PM programme with Evan Davis, and he of course is an author on economics, who spoke to the Chief Secretary of the Treasury. Well, the interview was ostensibly about the Labour U-turn, but she ended up sounding like she didn't know anything about economics at all.
One of Rishi Sunak, your leader's five pledges, is that debt should be falling. And the words he used were, we'll make sure our national debt is falling so that we can secure the future of public services. Now, on the latest projections, the latest official projections, debt is rising. Let's just be quite clear. Debt goes up over the next few years. It's higher in 4 years than it is now. It's not going to change that much in the next projection you'll get at the budget. What is puzzling me is how you can be even talking about tax cuts when a central pledge is getting debt down and debt is going up.
So the central pledge, it's one of our fiscal rules, which is that debt needs to be falling over the five-year fiscal forecast as a percentage of GDP, which it is.
No, it's higher in 5 years than now.
Not as a percentage of GDP.
Yeah, no, it's higher. It's going up. It's lower in the fifth year relative to the fourth year. So it goes down at the end of the projection. But in 5 years, I think it's higher at the end of the project. Yeah, 23.4, 89% of GDP. 28.9, it's 93% of GDP. Debt goes up. It falls at the end of 5 years a little bit. But that doesn't mean debt is coming down. That means debt is going up. It's higher. It's higher in 5 years than now.
It's falling as a percentage of GDP. Is
no,
there,
it's
I think
higher
it's
as a percentage of GDP.
I'm not sure. I think...
Well, this is really basic. I'm looking at the latest OBR table. Public sector net debt, ex-Bank of England, 28.9, 92.8%, 23.4, 89%. So it's up in 5 years. Now, I'm amazed that you don't know that debt is rising... But
no,
you're the one who's planning.
Percentage of GDP,
I'm looking at the percentage of GDP.
I think I need to have the figures. I've got different figures, so I think we just need to.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just suppose if debt is higher on the OBR forecast in 5 years than now, you couldn't possibly be cutting taxes while your pledge is that debt should be falling.
The point is, we have our fiscal rules, and within those, we have an amount of headroom. So we will only do things that are fiscally responsible and sit within our fiscal rules.
It's a really, really big point, this, isn't it? And one of us has obviously got it wrong. I think I'm looking at the right table, and I think I'm looking at the right line. And it's possible that the figures will all change. But at the moment, it looks to me like debt is higher in 5 years than it is now. And you're still talking about tax cuts. And I'm just wondering how you do that, if you're a... Pledging is debt falling is one of your key five pledges.
Percentage of GDP over the five-year forecast. Yes,
and
I'm looking at the percentage of GDP
line. That's the only relevant one.
I am. So I think that we've always said that we will only do things within our fiscal rules and where it is affordable for us to do so. So yes, we want to cut taxes. We believe that drives growth, but we will only do it if it sits within our fiscal rules.
Laura Trott. Interesting conversation. We should probably both go and look at the books, make sure we haven't made a mistake, but obviously... really interesting point about whether debt is going up or going down on your watch. Laura Trott, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, thank you so much.
So, Martin, what did you make of that? I don't think many people listening will be trusting her ladyship there. I think they'll be trusting the BBC. But he was really quite polite, wasn't he? You're saying, well, OK, you've got a different version of the figures. I've got all the OBS figures in front of me, and you say that debt is not going up.
Well, I think she's caught in the cleft stick, isn't she? Because the Tory party believes in tax cuts. They believe in them ideologically, and they also see them as the magic elixir which might allow them to win the next general election in this country. But at the same time, of course, there's no basis for tax cuts when the fiscal position of the state has been completely undermined by the 2008 crash and the COVID pandemic. And in other words, if you're going to be cutting public expenditure, not spending, you know, people, there's a big, I don't know if you saw this week, all the big queues of people trying to get into a national health dentist in St. Paul's. There's massive queues of hundreds and hundreds of people trying to get a dentist. And if in those situation, where is the case for any kind of tax cuts for the wealthiest section of the population? And in actual fact, if you're honest, you've got to accept that for at least a generation, there is going to be no decrease in taxes for the wealthiest section of the population. And probably there'll have to be an increase, but that's not what Tories want to hear. And that's why she comes out with this stuff, even though in actual fact, debt is increasing. And if you want to balance the books, which they claim they do, then you can't have tax cuts.
Well, Laura Trott, it seems to me she's someone who's put in place almost just as someone who's... I mean, she's got the various lines, she's got all the lines, but the thing is, he's actually quite a sophisticated economist. He's pulling apart what she's saying, well, actually, no, that doesn't make sense in this case. And anyway, debt's going up. What are you talking about?
Well, that's right. But I mean, if you think about Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, I mean, they basically, they sacked Sir Tom Scholar, who was the head of the Treasury, because they knew he would just say, you can't do this. It's not viable. And so they got rid of him, and then they put forward their budget, which then basically crashed the economy.
Okay, just finally on this, Martin, I mean, many people around the country are getting into debt, particularly with the rising interest rates and that sort of thing, with people with their mortgages, also through food inflation. I mean, and also the government, we know, is the actual official debt figure is rising. So does this matter?
It doesn't matter as much as Tories think. In actual fact, you can.
So Labour can spend what they want, really.
Well,
can
no,
they?
They can't spend what they mean. What was the other news this week? Of course, is the Labour Party cutting back on any kind of pledge to do anything.
That interview was on the back of that. So yeah. She was supposed to be trashing it, but then he trashed her, which I thought was rather wonderful. But anyway, does it matter? Did the Labour Party really have to rein back on all this green spending?
Well, they believe that they've got to, you know, not promise too much about anything, because otherwise the markets will punish them for saying that they're not going to bring the debt down. Now, in actual fact, you can actually, what will probably happen is the debt will continue to go up, because the capitalist system is in crisis. You can't just wish away debt. Debt hasn't disappeared in Japan since the crash in the 1980s. But there's a fantasy world where somehow the capitalist crisis will go away and the debt will come down and things will get back to normal.
If you listen to last week's podcast, you'll have heard at the start Manfred Petrich talking about how over 20 years Vladimir Putin and Russia did pay off all the debt, not only of Russia, but all the other Soviet countries as well, who refused to pay it. And they took it on. The Russians took it on. They slowly but surely paid it off. So it can be done.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is, there's a case for fiscal responsibility rather than just spending money and not thinking of the consequences. But on the other hand, there's far too much emphasis on debt as the problem. The problem isn't debt. The problem is more fundamental than that. And you might want to run up debts if you're going to invest in things that are worth
doing. Surely the greater the debt, the more power the city have.
Well, no, you could also change the way in which the government is financed. We actually borrow money from private banks, where you could, in fact, create a system like in China, where the banks are owned directly by the government, effectively, and they create the money supply. Well, and they can just cancel any debts to themselves at any point, if that's what they decide
anyway,
to do.
Anyway, on Monday, I was waiting on the local Points Western ITV news down here to hear all about our guest we've got now, David Miller, having won his employment tribunal. Well done, David. Well done.
And
it's nice and good to hear about people winning employment tribunals, especially when they're sacked by the great and the good of Bristol University, these incredibly intelligent people who seem to be slowly but surely becoming some sort of mega profit-making corporation, trying to bring in as many foreign students as possible because they get more money from those foreign students. But anyway, that by the by, can you just take us right back to the start of all of this? I mean, it was a landmark success. It's been called by the Evening Standard over Israel comments. But right at the very start of all this, there was a lobby group, wasn't there, within the university that accused you of anti-Semitism.
Well, right at the start, there were two students in my class who complained to an external Israel lobby group who made a complaint on their behalf. The university rejected the complaint because they weren't students.
And what were you saying to these students? What were you teaching
I
these
students? I was teaching, I did a lecture about Islamophobia, a lecture I've done on a number of occasions. And part of that lecture, about 5 minutes of it, and you can listen to it online since it was leaked, a recording of it was leaked to the Jewish News, and they put it on their site thinking it was condemnatory of me, which of course it wasn't. I was talking about the role of the Zionist movement as one of the pillars out of five, pushing forward and promoting Islamophobia in this country, which comes from the research I'd been doing at that stage for some 10 years. And they objected to this. When the lobby group complained, the university rejected the complaint, and then the lobby group corralled the Union of Jewish Students, which of course is also a Zionist organization, into complaining, and they corralled the president of the Bristol Jewish Society, which is a member of the Union of Jewish Students, and they complained. And because the Bristol Jewish Society's president was a student at the time, they accepted the complaint. They investigated it. They found I wasn't guilty of anti-Semitism. She appealed. They stayed the appeal until they'd introduced the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which, of course, changed the rules. Then they investigated me with a QC who found not anything I'd ever said was anti-Semitic. And then they decided that was fine. There was no problem, no case to answer. 6 weeks later, this is the short version. 6 weeks later, I said, I have been attacked and complained about by these two particular organizations. And then all hell breaks loose. You can't possibly, this is intimidation of students. I'm just simply reporting factually what happened to me. Massive campaign in the country, in the parliament, in press, over 100 members of the Houses of Lords and Commons wrote to get me sacked, Zion's professors at my university, Zion's professors outside the university, a huge long list of Zionist groups complained, maybe 30 different Zionist groups complained, asked me to be sacked. They investigated me again, found that I had not said anything which was anti-Semitic, surprise, and then sacked me anyhow because the conduct that I had shown them wasn't fit for an academic. And what they meant by that was that some students had been upset, i.e. Zionist students didn't like that I was an anti-Zionist. They said it wasn't anything to do with my anti-Zionism. It was only to do with the fact that I had mentioned students. But that story, that narrative about why they'd sacked me, collapsed entirely in the tribunal.
So aren't university lecturers, professors supposed to have tenure, which is a very strong, the idea is that basically you do have freedom of speech there, and that unless you are caught guilty of doing, now, you know, it doesn't sound to me as if they've followed their own rules.
No, there's no such thing as tenure in the UK, never has been. But there are nevertheless strong protections in the law under academic freedom and also under freedom of speech, which should protect someone from like me from saying things which are obviously not racist and which are simply an expression of what are now regarded by the tribunal as protected views, anti-Zionist views. But they didn't understand or want to deal with that because of the pressure they were under. They also had people who were giving them money saying that they were going to stop giving them money at Zionist foundations. So they were under huge pressure, and they found a way to get rid of me. They thought it was defensible, and it came to court, and it fell apart around their feet.
Now, what about the pressure on you? It must have been quite a fight. Did you ever feel that, listen, I just want to walk away from this?
No, never. I mean, never for a second did I consider any such nonsense. I mean, if you decide that this is a difficult thing and you're going to try and apologise and be nice to them and see if we can all be friends, then you can do that. I was never going to do that because I knew that wouldn't work. Then the strategy we adopted was to say, look, these are perfectly respectable anti-Zionist views. They might sound extreme to someone who believes in genocide in Gaza, but to me and to everyone else around the world who doesn't believe in genocide in Gaza, they're perfectly respectable. And in order to establish that, we have to have a fight about this. And the fight was at the court. And the tribunal decided that, yes, the anti-Zionist views of the sort I espouse are protected under the law, under the Equality Act, and you cannot be discriminated against because you've got anti-Zionist views, which the university, in their own evidence at the tribunal, effectively confirmed. I mean, extraordinary.
Well, that is extraordinary. Can you take us through that? It almost sounds comic.
It was, I mean, this was better than a soap opera. I mean, There were four university witnesses, but I'll not bore you with all of the ins and outs. The first witness was the retired professor who investigated me. And he admitted in the end that he hadn't followed the university's own rules on investigations, which was that you should investigate both sides of the allegations. He'd only investigated the students' allegations and what effect my comments might have had on them, not what the greater context was. And he admitted in the end that that was a mistake, and he didn't even interrogate them on the obvious falsehoods which they told him in their evidence. And so that was the first thing. The second thing was that both he and the person who sacked me, who's now gone on to a much better paid job in a different university, Professor Jane Norman, they both conceded that it wasn't really the comments I'd made about students, about them working closely with the Zionist regime, and there being a question of whether they were pawns or not. That was me being polite, because of course they were active agents of the Zionist regime. So that it wasn't those comments which was the key thing. The key thing was that those comments were allied with anti-Zionist views, which is that Zionism is a racist, colonial and genocidal ideology, always has been and always will be. And
so hang on, David, because Zionism hasn't always been genocidal. You'll find many Jews have gone to Israel wishing to be at peace with the Palestinians. In fact, there are, you know, a few now who are actually very anti-racist, vehemently.
Right. Au contraire. So the most radical of the kibbutzim, the kibbutzniks, was an organization called Hashomer Hatzair, who had a, I mean, do you want this history lesson? Who had a series of kibbutzim, including who went to these kibbutzim? Bernie Sanders went there. Tony Benn went there. The Yigael Glückstein, who became Tony Glyph, who founded the Socialist Workers' Party, he was there. That's how he broke with Zionism, because he went to their kibbutzim. He wrote about the Hashomer Hatzair in 1946, before the creation of the State of Israel, denouncing them as being, you know, all in favour of having Arab-only kibbutzim as well, but also in favour of evicting the Palestinians from their land. And they participated in the Nakba. So there were no Zionists who were anti Zionist at the time, who didn't want to.
No, genocide is what we're talking about here.
Well, the Nakba was a genocide.
Yes.
The Nakba was a genocide, and there were no Zionists who did not want to participate in that. There was no faction of Zionists who did not want to and did not participate in it. The most radical of them participated as well, including in the elite Palmach of the Haganah. So that's so yes, always being genocidal things. That's the view which is now protected in British law, right?
Well done. Anyway, let's go back to the tribunal. Who else were the witnesses? So, what did they say?
So both of these witnesses, the retired Professor Banting, who investigated me, and the Professor Norman, who sacked me, both admitted that it was the heinousness of my anti-Zionist comments as perceived by them and by the students, which was what led to me being sacked. And they both admitted that the university's alleged reasons for sacking me were incorrect, and that was the first element of their case gone, right? So not only did they wrongly dismiss me because they didn't properly investigate, but they also sacked me because of my views. And then we came to the best part of the proceedings, and that was in the personage of Professor Judith Squires, the second most senior person at the university, who is a professor of political theory, so ought to know a little bit about some of the matters we're about to discuss. And at the beginning of the case, the university had come to the case accepting the two QC's reports they'd had, which said that I wasn't in any way anti-Semitic, and they accepted that. And as soon as the case started, they said, oh, we want to change our minds about that. And so they changed their minds to say, because I was claiming that my ideas should be protected under law, they came to the case saying that shouldn't be the case, and that my ideas were not worthy of respect in a democratic society, which is the technical language in the Equality Act. Right. So that was a legal mistake, a fundamental legal mistake, which the university should really not have taken that advice from their counsel, but they did. So anyhow, here comes Professor Squires, the professor of political theory, the expert on Foucault and all things post-structural. And she's asked by my counsel, so you think that Professor Miller's views are not worthy of respect in a democratic society? No, they're not. So you obviously think then that they're akin to fascism, which is the test, right? Your views are acceptable and worthy of respect if they're not akin to fascism. So what they had to establish was that my views were akin to fascism. And she looked startled. She didn't know how to answer that question.
She wasn't expecting it.
And so my counsel said, but surely your counsel will have told you that is the legal test, and that is what you must be advancing. And she goes, oh yes, his views are akin to Nazism. So that was it. She'd lost. But the best bit was the next bit, where he says, okay, so let's take you through a hypothetical example, Professor Squires. Let's imagine that the Anglo-Saxons of Britain excluded all of the non-Anglo-Saxons from the country and made them go and live in Cardiff or in Cornwall. And the judge intervenes at this point and says, Mr. Samur, that's my name of my barrister, do you mean all of the non-Anglo-Saxons? And he goes, oh no, 75%. And the remaining 25% get to stay in Britain, but they're denied equality in housing, in jobs, in access to democracy. And none of the ones who've been expelled can ever come back again, but every Anglo-Saxon anywhere in the world has a right to come and live in Britain. Would that be racist? He said. Yes, she says. And would it be wrong for a professor to say Anglo-Saxonism is racism and it should be opposed? Oh no, it wouldn't be wrong to say that. So she's completely contradicted herself. And it led to an amazing scene. She didn't know what to say, and she looked at the laptop. They had to break to get something written on paper, and they came back, and she said in a quiet voice, when asked, are Professor Miller's views akin to Nazism? She said, yes. And that was their case demolished. They demolished it themselves.
Amazing. What's the ramifications, do you think, for other, not just university lecturers, but others that are threatened with cases of anti-Semitism, accused of anti-Semitism, the people in all sorts of broadcasting, for example?
Well, this is a law which affects everybody in employment.
doesn't just affect academics or journalists. It affects everybody, local council workers, people in all sorts of in the private sector too. You cannot discriminate against someone who has anti-Zionist views on the basis of their anti-Zionist views. So it has very wide ramifications across the whole of the coming battle against the Zionists. You know, they're putting more and more pressure, having more and more people sacked, and this is a line in the sand where we can start to push back.
Listen, this case of yours at the university anyway started a long time before the genocide. Do you think that this is a sort of home front battle that's going on here that was actually started before the genocide and that this is premeditated?
Premeditated in what sense?
Well, in other words, that the idea is to get the British academia, people of influence in Britain, to be pro-Israeli, to get rid of pro-Palestinians. Oh. I mean, look what happened to Jeremy Corbyn, for example, before the genocide took place.
Sure.
Because we have heard racist comments from the Israeli government for many years, and I'm just wondering whether they'd been planning what's going on now, this genocide, for a long time, and thinking, well, you know, we need to actually prepare the ground by having a battle against pro-Palestinians in Britain in any influential position.
Well, I mean, I don't know that there was a specific genocide plan in mind. That seems unlikely, but certainly they have been organising this way for a very long period. I mean, the foreign minister of Israel, Abba Eban, famously said in 1972 in a speech in the US that the new anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism and that these two things are indistinguishable. And they've been trying to push that line ever since then.
How can anti-Semitism be anti-Zionism? How can the two be? I mean, how can you, it's almost like you're saying that Zionists are not Jews.
Well, what their line is that anti-Zionists may claim that they're against the political philosophy, but secretly they're anti-Jewish. They say they're anti-Zionist, but they're really secretly anti-Jewish. That's part of the story. And the other part of the story is that they say that Jewish self-determination is an inalienable right of the Jewish people. And anyone who opposes Jewish self-determination, i.e. opposes genocide, is somehow racist. That's the end of their line. And of course, it's ridiculous because, of course, Jewish self-determination does not require, cannot be allowed to require, should not be allowed to require genocide. It's completely obvious that that's the case. But nevertheless, they've pushed this line. They've brought in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism, developed by the Israeli government and then lodged in the IHRA as a weapon of choice. And then they populate their groups around the country, around the world, so that they've got boots on the ground to take complaints, to destroy Jeremy Corbyn, to attack Bernie Sanders, even though he's a Zionist himself, etc., etc.
So the IHRA definition, where does that stand now after your case?
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because the judgment in my case drives a coach and horses through the idea that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are identical. They're not identical, according to British law now, precedent British law. And I'm very, very pleased that I've been involved in doing that.
Yeah, Martin, what do you make of this this question of David's case versus the genocide? Because I've been watching this for many years. I've been accused of anti-Semitism myself back in, gosh, it was a long time ago, 1990s, and I remember thinking, well, what's this about? I'm starting to look over in the Middle East now and saying, well, that's what it's about.
Well, I mean, regardless of whether your views are correct or not, it's surely just his political views to oppose the state of Israel. I mean, it should be okay to oppose the existence of the state of Israel. Some people, and plenty of people in mainstream Labour Party, don't oppose the existence of the state of Israel.
But it's not just the state of Israel you're opposing, surely. It's this political philosophy behind it.
Well, it may be, yeah, but I mean, the point is, should Israel be allowed to exist? Now, Ernie Bevin, who used to be British Foreign Secretary, was firmly of the view that it shouldn't be allowed to exist. But he was overruled in cabinet, and we've now got a Labour Party leadership which believes that the state of Israel has a right to exist. Now, I think the idea, it's there now, just like the loyalists in Northern Ireland, they're there. But nevertheless, it should just be regarded as political dispute. Some people think that Crimea is part of Ukraine. They genuinely believe that. It's ridiculous because most of the people in Crimea are Russian and voted in a referendum to leave the Ukraine. Several times, in fact. But those people have a political view that Ukraine is part of, Crimea is part of Ukraine. That is a political view, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it. And all that this court has said is that this is a protected political view. And it doesn't mean you have to agree with David Miller's view.
Of course, of course. Well, I mean, but the idea that states have a right to exist is of course a fanciful one. I mean, I used to live in Scotland, and before I left Scotland to come down to England, I voted in a referendum to destroy the British state, i.e., to vote yes for Scottish independence. That would have broken up the British state. There's no inherent right of a state to exist, and least of all states like the United Kingdom, which have several constituent parts which are sort of welded together by a sticky tape.
But isn't it? Yeah, but hang on, it's a bit more than that. It's whether other countries recognise them, isn't it? It's whether the big superpowers recognise them, then whether they exchange ambassadors, then you've got a state.
Sure, that's right. But I mean,
but you don't have any right. I mean, if someone says, "I don't want to send you an ambassador," then you don't have a state, do you?
Well, you have a state when you establish a state, but there's no right for it to exist in the abstract. That's the key question.
Yeah. So, Martin, what do you make of what's your take on the implications of David's judgment this week?
Well, I think it is important because this international definition, which conflates Zionism and the state of Israel with anti-Semitism, as you say, it drives the coach and horses through it. And of course, British law is case law, so that becomes the law. And that is a very strong, in a way, you've obviously been given a very hard time here, but you have, in fact, triumphed against those people who are trying to use this kind of technique to silence dissent. And you can imagine that the UK lawyers for Israel are grinding their teeth this evening, and as well they might. And of course they tried to close this little show down when we were on Bristol Community Radio. They're very active, these people. I mean, when you say the genocide didn't start in this recent. Obviously, it's gone in in the 1940s. The state was established on a massive murderous rampage of ethnic cleansing. Every bit as bad as what happened in Yugoslavia. And I used to be an aid worker, and the people who did that were rewarded. They became the leaders of the new state. They weren't sent to The Hague at all. And of course, that is the logic of Hamas fighting back from the other side, saying that's how states are established. You've got to be absolutely ruthless, and if you win, then you become a state, and you can't be punished because you're too strong to be punished.
Okay, David, can you drill into why it is that the British and the Americans are so unequivocally supporting the Israelis in this current genocide? There seems to be something going on behind the scenes, under the carpet, if you want, that I can't see any benefit for Britain. I can't see any benefit for the United States. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, it's clear that the US and the UK, especially the US, has seen Israel as being a valuable weapon in West Asia for some time. That, as people say, that sometimes the attack dog gets off the leash, and Israel is well and truly off the leash.
It's in an important part of the world, just say geographically, isn't it?
It's important geographically in terms of natural resources and in terms of the oil. But of course, the rest of the West Asia, many of the states in West Asia, the Arab states, are themselves Western clients. So your question is opposite, I would say. But look, what's going on here is that the Israelis are an expansionist regime. They want to have a greater Israel, which in their ambitions includes all of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, parts of Iraq, little parts of Turkey, Egypt as well. So they're a kind of attempting imperialist power. And there's a question about how far they will go along with their main sponsor, which of course is the US. And the US has got the same question. How far can it go along? Will it go along when the Israelis are committing genocide? It's not that the US cares about the killing of thousands and thousands of Palestinian children. It's that its power calculuses have started to change because the power of the US is on the way down. And we see that, obviously, in the massive defeat they faced in Ukraine, but also in their inability to confront Ansar Allah in Yemen, where they've done some demonstration attacks, but they've let it be known that they're not going to escalate against Ansar Allah because they're scared.
I don't know what about the religious aspect? Because this is something, you've been looking to Islamophobia a lot, haven't you? There's obviously a religious aspect down there. Many of the people who are the victims of this genocide are not Muslims, but the whole idea of the Zionist state in Israel opposing the surrounding Muslim countries, particularly Iran, religion is almost at the heart of this.
I would say that religion is not at the heart of it. That geopolitics is the most central thing, but there is a religious dimension to it. That's certainly the case. I mean, part of the conflict there is over Al-Aqsa is a religious conflict between Muslims and Jews over the significance of Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock and the building of the temple and all of that stuff. So that is part of it. Of course, the Zionists started off as being a secularist movement full of atheists, but there are now, of course, such a thing as religious Zionists who are part of Netanyahu's government, and so that's part of the calculus.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, this is the Holy Land, isn't it? This is almost like the epicentre of the Abrahamic faiths here.
Well, it is. I mean,
it's like they've turned it into, they've turned it into hell, Gaza. I'm trying to drag you towards a bit of a spiritual dimension here.
Well, I mean, there is a spiritual dimension to it. I mean, that's true. I mean, I'm kind of admitting that, right? So, you know, I mean, the so-called Hebron massacre in 1929, there was a religious conflict over access to both Al-Aqsa Mosque and indeed the mosque in Hebron, the Ibrahimi Mosque there, where there had been incursions by radical religious Jewish settlers, and that was part of the conflict there. So there is a dimension to that, if you look at the sort of settler movement and the temple movement, who want to build the third temple, who see the coming of the Messiah, and this is what the Christian Zionists are all about. They're best of mates with the Zionists because they think that, you know, it's going to encourage the Armageddon, and then of course the Jews will all be killed. That's their view, isn't it?
Well, supposedly. What if the boot was on the other foot? What if the Zionists had taken over, I don't know, somewhere like Mecca, which was a very important site of the Muslims? So if the boot was on the other foot, surely, I mean, you can see why the Israelis actually feel like that they want their own, you know, their own Jerusalem, their own temple, this sort of thing. This is surely at the heart of it. Like I'm coming back again, saying, "Well, this is really surely they have their right to have that, don't they?"
Well, they have the right to expel the Muslims and not
Well, they have
Al-Aqsa.
The right to maybe have agree with the Muslims to move their place.
They did have agreements, but they haven't anymore because of the occupation.
I mean, there was a chance, wasn't there, back in the 1990s with Rabin? It seems that
I don't think so, to have a
peace agreement. He was assassinated.
He was assassinated by the far right settlers. Yes, of course.
Friend of Netanyahu, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, look, there was a chance. Prior to Zionism, I mean, the early settlements going back, I mean, you know, there were Jews there, not in an unbroken line, but, you know, before the creation of the Zionist movement, and they lived cheap by jowl. This is what the guys from Natura Carta are always banging on about, you know, that they didn't want a Jewish state, they lived with the Muslims, they were friends, and there wasn't an imperialist project. And it's what Zionism that brings the imperialist project. And of course, it affects all of the Jews, whether they're anti-Zionist or not.
Okay, we are just looking at a report on Declassified UK by Matt Kennard a couple of days ago. He's saying that actually Israeli aircraft have been landing here in Britain, US aircraft landing here in Britain, and we are complicit in this genocide.
Well, of course we are. I mean, Britain is not as complicit as the US, but it clearly is complicit. I mean, the involvement of the SAS, certainly in Cyprus. We don't know if they've been in Gaza or directly, like some of the US special forces have been. They've been intelligence flights, as Matt and others at Declassified have been reporting, from the bases. Remember, there's British military bases in Cyprus still, and they've been flying intelligence flights, no doubt sharing the intelligence with the Zionists and with the Israelis. I mean, yes, of course, that's complicity. And that means that Rishi Sunak should be going to The Hague along with Netanyahu and Gallant and Herzog.
It's been a bit of a double-edged sword this week, though, hasn't it? Because we've had the results of the Elbit 7 trial here in Bristol as well. These are people from Palestine Action who were taking direct action against this Israeli firm, Elbit, which are manufacturing drones and all sorts of other hideous, stuff that's being used for genocide.
Battle-tested on Palestinian children, yes.
Yeah, so, and this is one of the ways they actually sell the stuff, is they say, well, we do test this on civilian populations, yeah. Blah, blah. So what do you make of that trial? Apparently their defence was that we had consent to do it, which is a pity, because certainly the historic trials I remember, the defences they were using were things like trying to stop a greater crime.
Yeah, I mean, this is a jury trial. The jury, by all accounts, weren't very engaged with the defendants, and who knows what there was in their minds. But we haven't got to sentencing yet. We don't know if they'll be custodial sentences or not. So far, almost all of the Palestine Action people who've been charged with things, and there's been a lot of them, have got off, have been found not guilty because of their defence that they're trying to commit a larger crime, which has been accepted by many juries up and down the country. But Palestine Action is the cutting edge of the Palestine solidarity movement in this country, and we should be doing all we can to support their actions, including, of course, donating to the crowdfunders they've got. Some of them haven't got legal aid and are faced with large legal bills. So it's important that people find out about the Elbit 7 and about Palestine Action, because that's the kind of cutting edge of Palestine solidarity work in this country, I think.
A lot of these things do depend. I mean, obviously, you know, you are advising your lawyer. It helps to be a sociologist when you're doing that. But how on earth do you go about finding a decent lawyer in a case like this? I mean, sometimes people will be just going, oh, gosh, you know, suddenly they'll grab the first lawyer that comes along. Is it not an easy job?
That's not a good idea. You need to take advice on who's the best lawyer to take. I mean, I'm involved with an organization called the Left Legal Fighting Fund, which was set up, founded by Chris Williamson when he was drummed out of the Labour Party, and which used money that he won in court from the Labour Party to set it up, and has been supporting a number of big cases. So, you know, organizations like that, or Palestine Legal in the US, or the European Legal Center in Brussels, they can all advise on good lawyers. Sometimes they can help. So I would advise doing that. I mean, the legal team I have, Zilla Rahman from Rahman Law, has been fantastic and very supportive from the beginning. And Zach Samour, who's himself Palestinian, as the barrister, I mean, who's the one who absolutely destroyed Professor Squires in court. I mean, that was just a joy to see. But they're committed and they're knowledgeable. I have had other lawyers during this process over the last 4 years, and some of them have not been as well versed in the politics of this. In particular, those who had, perhaps, for example, just employment law specialisms, which, of course, this is an employment law quick case. But you need to know the politics, and it's important in a case like this that you have legal counsel who are absolutely abreast of and sensitive to the politics of this, as they were.
So you're going to get your job back?
Well, let's see. We've got a remedies hearing, and the judge will be determining how much money I get and what kind of compensation there is, and whether the university has to take me back. All of those questions, I think, are up for discussion. But let's see.
I mean, normally they don't, do they? They will normally rather pay you off and get rid of you rather than...
Normally that's the case, yeah. Normally courts don't require people to be taken back, but it's not unheard of.
Has this affected your career, do you think?
Well, I mean, I've been cleared and for the fourth investigation, I doubt I'm going to get an academic job in the UK again. I'm not averse to trying, but it's obviously totally changed my career. I'm now I work in journalism and I still do academic research, if you like, but it's geared towards my show Palestine Declassified and writing to various websites, and I've kind of taken a different trajectory, and that's allowed me actually to spend much more of my time investigating Zionism than I would otherwise have been able to do had I been in a university.
I was going to ask you that, because you know, you would have thought a lot of your research work has gone down the pan now if you're this kind of media character.
No, not at all. I mean, I mean the work I do and the journalism I do is based on research. I mean, our show Palestine Declassified is based on research. We break stories all the time because we do investigations, unlike actually many academics or indeed many journalists.
Can you explain to listeners what sociology is? What attracted you to it?
What attracted me to sociology was the fact that, I mean, let's put it this very crudely. I mean, I when I started to do sociology, I realised that some of the weird things that I thought about the world were actually true. about inequality, about imperialism. And I realised there was a whole body of thought and of ideas which actually engaged with the feelings I had of growing up in Edinburgh and experiencing the conflict in Ireland and the Falklands War and all of that. And how would I make sense of that? And actually, I alighted upon a discipline which I believe is way better at understanding those questions than any other discipline, including political science.
Yeah, brilliant. Anyway, just to round up, we're going to have a listen now to General Wesley Clark. He was on the BBC's Channel 4 News last week, talking about what's going on in Gaza. I'd love to get both of you's reaction to. He introduced me to the idea of escalation dominance that the Americans want to have in the Middle East.
I spoke to the retired US general and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, Wesley Clark. I asked him what action he thinks the US should now take.
In a crisis like this, you have to take the initiative away from the enemy. What I would call it is you have to establish escalation dominance. You keep apologizing for escalating as they keep hitting. So you got to hit back so hard that they say, okay, we've had enough. We're not going to strike back again. And that means you must go to the source. And the source is Iran. So you have to pick out the targets in Iran that will dissuade the Revolutionary Guards and the Ayatollahs from continuing this campaign.
So that does mean that you're talking about strikes in Iran itself, on Iranian territory.
That's right.
Yeah.
That would be, if I were in the chain of command, that's what I'd be recommending, because the tit for tat doesn't work. And we know that historically. We saw this when I was a young officer in Vietnam. Tit for tat doesn't work. You want to make a difference, you must use decisive force. Take out these small outposts. Take them out. Don't strike once. Go back again and again. But you must also go to the source, and that source is Iran. The Iranian government is in deep trouble. Most of the people don't want it there, but they can't get rid of it. So I keep hearing from my Iranian friends, send the B-52s in. Now, we're not going to send any B-52s in, I don't think. But this is a time where the United States has to establish its escalation dominance over Iran.
Right. And how do you factor in American domestic politics here? Because you have Donald Trump saying President Biden is leading you into World War III and saying none of this would have happened had he been president. How does that change the calculation as to what to do?
Well, I think that it's inevitable that there will be some effort on the part of politicians to make some domestic hay out of this. But I think statesmen have to rise above the domestic politics. And I think this is a case where President Biden has to choose what's right for the country. And, you know, you have to be careful how you read this, because when I talk to Muslim Americans in the United States and Iranian Americans, what they're looking for from the president is strength. They're not looking for compromise. They know what the Iranian government's about. They know what its intent is. So they're looking to see a president who exhibits strength. It hasn't happened in Ukraine. And that started the slide. Really, Afghanistan did. And then Ukraine. And so what they see is an American administration which doesn't respond with the full force which it's capable. And they attribute it to timidity. They're looking for strong leadership. So I think the domestic politics of this are that the president will come out better politically at home and abroad if he responds more strongly.
So that's U.S. former General Wesley Clark there talking about imagining himself into the U.S. chain of command, David, with this idea of escalation dominance and particularly about hitting Iran.
Well, I've already alluded to what's actually going on here, and that is that the U.S. power is declining by the day. They can't even contain Ansarallah. Let me talk about that for a second. So in the case of Ansarallah, who run the government of Yemen and who took most of the weapons and most of the army as part of the civil war, and the weapons that had been supplied by the Saudis, and of course eventually they'd come from the Americans. So Ansarallah has a huge supply of weaponry, not just from Iran, but also from captured from the Saudis. And what the Americans did when the Ansarallah started the blockade against boats going to Israel or Israeli boats was that they said that they were going to create this thing called Operation Protect Prosperity. And I think that the person who came up with that slogan should have been paid better, you know. And what happened then was the US Navy said, guys, we haven't got enough boats to do this. And then Spain, Italy and France said, guys, we're out. We're not part of this. And then the Americans let it be known through the pages of the New York Times that they were scared of bombing Ancirella seriously, because what could happen in principle, they thought, was that Ancirella might sink some US Navy ships. Well, of course they'd do that. Of course that's what would happen. These are, and that, you know, and that reveals the whole charade of US global power, is that actually the projection of power by the US Navy is no more than floating metal hulks, which are targets for sophisticated weaponry, which Ancirella absolutely have. So they're scared that Ancirella will sink 1, 2, 3, 4, lots of their boats in the Red Sea and in the Mediterranean. And that is really the end of the idea of American power.
The British have just decided they're going to pull HMS Diamond out. It's very well defended and a very modern ship, and put an older ship in, which isn't so well defended. I looked at that and I thought, is this bait that they're sticking in there?
It's crazy. I mean, the Americans...
It's just the Red Sea we're talking about.
The Americans rang up Ancirella and said, guys, we're about to bomb X, Y, and Z. And Ancirella said, thanks very much, guys. And they evacuated the bases, and then the bombs came. I mean, this is tit for tat. As he says, they cannot escalate to dominance. They haven't got the ability. Yes, they've got bases all over the place, but these are effectively isolated groups of US soldiers, 13,000 in Qatar, 2,500 in Syria, etc. And the ones in Syria and indeed Iraq, the Iraqi parliament has declared that they should all leave. And the Iraqi resistance, not just the Iraqi armed forces, the Iraqi resistance, Islamic resistance, 23 separate factions, is conducting a war against all of those bases in both Syria and Iraq, and indeed attacking Israel in the Golan Heights. So there's a real pressure on Israel, and the Americans cannot staunch the pressure. They cannot take the pressure away, and that's the problem they've got.
Well, to be fair to Krishnan Gurumurthy, he then said, well, what about the idea of just persuading the Israelis to stop bombing Gaza? Wesley Clark's, no, I don't think we should be doing that. I'll put the full clip up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But anyway, where is this Gaza Red Sea thing in the Middle East heading, do you think?
Well, I think that Al-Aqsa Flood, when it was launched, that was a moment where I think many people saw the weakness and potential weakness of the Zionist project. That if the Palestinian factions, it wasn't just Hamas, it was Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front and the Democratic Front and all those organizations. And the events since then have only confirmed my view that actually the Zionist entity is very, very fragile. They're being kicked by the resistance in Gaza. They're scared of going into Lebanon because last time they went into Lebanon, they were kicked out of Lebanon by Hezbollah, and Hezbollah are immeasurably stronger now than they were then. There's, of course, pressure from Syria, from Iraq, from Ancirella, and, you know, the escalation ladder, as the axis of resistance, the so-called axis of resistance puts it, means that you will have Iran drawn further and further into this conflict directly. And once you've done that, there is no possibility of the Israelis breaching the boycott which Ancirella have instituted, because of course they've breached it by goods arriving through Saudi and then Jordan, and the Iranians will close all that down, and there will be no possibility of them breaking that siege, and that's the end of the Zionist project.
But, I mean, surely this attack on the 7th of October was a disaster. I mean, look at the kill ratio. It's something like 100 to 1, 100 Palestinians killed for every Israeli that was killed on the 7th of October. And of course, many of them have been taken as hostages and are being killed by Israeli US bombs right now.
Sure. I mean, that's absolutely true. It's a genocide, isn't it? It's an appalling genocide. But militarily, they're not defeating the Palestinian resistance factions. That's the interesting thing. I mean, many of us, I guess, have seen the footage of these Merkava tanks being blown up by guys in flip-flops and barefoot, and that's an ongoing process where their forces are being degraded at a rate of knots.
Thanks very much, David. I don't know if you can just give us your social media contacts, and so people are interested in following what you're up to.
So on X, formerly Twitter, I am tracking_power, and if you want to donate to my crowdfunder, because I still have quite a lot of legal costs outstanding, it's at fightingfund.com. www.freedomfighters.org.
And if they want to find out who those lawyers are, seem to do quite a good job, didn't they? David Miller, thanks very much for joining us. Martin, we're going to hear now from Wesley Clark, but a long time ago, same Wesley Clark, talking about some plans revealed to him in the Pentagon to invade and attack seven countries in 5 years.
I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I'd worked for him as a White House fellow in the 1970s. All this is in the book. And I said, am I doing okay on CNN? He said, yeah, fine. He said, I'm thinking about it. He says, I read your book. And he said, this is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. Well, he said, thanks. That's all the time I've got. I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess it's they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so they think, but they can attack states. And they want to look strong, and so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists. And, you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset, and then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. And I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then, it came back to me, a 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991, he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number three position in the Pentagon. And I had gone to see him when I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center. I had met him one time. He said, if you ever get to Washington, come look me up. They always say that. Well, I was there in Washington. It was a Friday afternoon. I'd visited Colin Powell. He'd given me 5 minutes of his precious time and sent me on my way, and I was bored in the Pentagon, and I thought, I'll just go, who can I see? I think I'll see Wolfowitz. So I called, and up there, he was available. Scooter Libby came to the door. I met Scooter for the first time, and he brought me in, and I said to Paul, I said, and this is 1991, I said, Mr. Secretary, you must be pretty happy with the performance of the troops in Desert Storm. And he said, well, yeah, he said, but not really, he said, because the truth is we should have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't. And this was just after the Shia uprising in March of 91, which we had provoked, and then we kept our troops on the sidelines and didn't intervene. And he said, but one thing we did learn, he said, we learned that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. He said, and we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet client regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're an American, you ought to be concerned about the strategy of the United States in this region. What is our aim? What is our purpose? Why are we there? Why are Americans dying in this region? That is the issue.
Well, he's changed his tune, hasn't he? So, yeah, there's a little gap at the end there, but I just took a bit out where there was some waffly talk, and amazing that someone can sort of turn themselves on their heads from saying, you know, why are Americans dying there, to now encouraging war with Iran.
Well, obviously, we'll have to look into the personal development of that individual.
Maybe he got his knuckles wrapped.
Well, it's quite likely that he was probably, you know, words were had, and he was told to get in line.
But I do
find
course,
he's now overcompensating for his previously somewhat critical views by being, you know, the loudest cheerleader for the pointless war with Iran he seems to want.
Yeah, and so what's the motivation behind that? One wonders. Anyway, look, the point here is, the US is a very peculiar place in a way, in that they kind of wear their heart on their sleeve, don't they, to a large extent. They're quite open about these encouragement of the genocide, this sort of thing. I remember, for example, John McCain, Senator John McCain, was just a totally gung-ho. But the thing is, if you're trying to be successful in war and geopolitics, you do have to play your cards, play your cards rather close to your chest. They don't seem to bother at all.
Well, it's a narcissistic element of their culture.
Right. You're right.
They only talk to themselves, so they don't really listen to what anybody else says. And everything is thought of in terms of their needs, their exceptionalism, America, the indispensable nation, all of that stuff. And of course, that's mirrored in the eschatological views of these Zionist leadership. And of course, in Britain, what we've got is, well, we just do that, don't we? I mean, we go to war. I mean, Britain has been going to war all over the world for hundreds of years. It's just what we do. It's part of who we are. So that's, you know, all three countries have got essentially narcissistic aspects to their collective personalities.
I will also say Matt Campbell, who I will be have an interview with him next week. Matt Campbell, who lost his brother in the 9/11 attacks, has just had a bit of a depressing bad decision from the Attorney General, and so I'll be putting up a link on our show page to that. This, of course, is referring really back to that Wesley Clark interview there about the launch of the War on Terror, and I'll put a link up on our show page this week and next week to his crowdfunder, where he's trying to get a bit more money to just keep the pressure on the legal system to reopen his brother's inquest, who died in the 9/11 attack. So Matt is stalwartly carrying on, trying to get the British legal system to do their stuff. And we'll, after the break, we'll be looking at the Putin interview with Alex Craner, and also looking at the rather peculiar announcement about the cancer of King Charles, and David Halpin, our resident doctor, will be telling us what he thinks was going on there.
Listen, all of you people, come and take a few lessons from me. Get yourself prepared for Judgment Day. Hallelujah to you. When you hear the trumpet blast, then you know you're home at last. Open up them pearly gates for me. Why don't you open up them pearly gates? Open up them pearly gates. Open up them pearly gates for me. Hallelujah, hallelujah. When you hear the trumpet blast,
Here begins the 13th verse of the 52nd chapter of the book of Isaiah. See, my servant shall prosper. He shall be exalted and lifted up and shall be very high. Just as there were many who were astonished at him, so marred was his appearance, beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of mortals. So he shall startle any nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which had not been told them, they shall see, and that which they had not heard, they shall contemplate. Who has believed what we have heard? And to whom has the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before them like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering and acquainted with infirmity, as one from whom others hide their faces. He was despised. We held him of no account. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases. Yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole. And by his bruises, we are healed. And we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have all turned to our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Here ends the first lesson.
Get together one more time. Believe in astrology. Yeah, that's right. That's right, baby. I am a Sagittarius. The most philosophical of all the signs. But anyway, I don't believe in it. I think it's a bunch of bullshit myself. But I'll tell you this, man. I'll tell you this. I don't know what's gonna happen, man. But I want to have my kicks before the whole shithouse goes up in flames. All right.
So there's good old Jim Morrison murdered, assassinated, whatever you want to call it, 1971 in Paris, and yeah, quite clearly killed off. I'm sure there are documentaries around about that. In fact, one of the best books on that subject generally is John Potash's book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. In Jim's case, he had the added interesting connection of his father, who was a rear admiral in the US Navy, who was behind the one of the people behind the Gulf of Tonkin incident that started the Vietnam War, a false flag event. So, yeah, and there is an interview around with his father where he talks a bit about Jim. You can tell there was a bit of tension. And I remember Jim in interviews said, oh, yeah, he was asked about his father. He says, my father is dead, man. Well, I mean, obviously he was, you know, maybe he understood that he had a role in starting the Vietnam War, that everyone in the late 60s and early 70s in the States was campaigning so strongly against. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. What you just heard there was Open Up Them Pearly Gates from 1964 and The Seekers, as well as that was a recording from 1970 from The Doors Live in Boston. Do you believe in astrology, Martin?
Not really.
No?
No.
What about, because we've got this thing just starting at the moment, haven't we, called the Year of the Dragon?
Practicing Satanists.
Which is the, for some reason, the Chinese use the moon to decide on when their new year is. And what do you make of all that? I know you're quite into the I Ching, aren't you, on the side. What do you make of the, is there any significance in it, or is it just complete nonsense?
I think all human ideas are intrinsically interesting because they're human. But that doesn't mean they're right or that they describe reality accurately. They are part of what we are.
I thought you did the I Ching occasionally, didn't you?
I've had a great interest in all of these. I've got
did
great
you get
interest.
Any, ever get anything from it?
I've got a great interest in all sorts of human beliefs, including spiritual beliefs, occult beliefs, and all the rest of it, because it's about human beings. And human beings are fascinating to me. But I don't necessarily believe in the sense of believing in the things that I'm interested in.
Well, fair enough. I mean, isn't it a kind of Chinese version of your horoscope?
Chinese astrology.
You've done the I Ching a few times. I know you have. And, did you do it a few times and think, oh, this is a waste of time, I'm going to stop doing this?
Well, I mean,
do you get anything from it?
Well, I mean, I've done all sorts of other things as well as the I Ching, as you can imagine.
Yes
you
or
know,
no? Come
not,
on.
Not least, to you know, psychedelic drugs.
All
of these things are interesting.
I know it's interesting. I'm just asking you about the I Ching specifically.
What about it?
Did you get anything from it at all?
It's one of the oldest books written by human beings and is therefore intrinsically interesting. Confucius said he read the I Ching because it was one of the oldest books when he was alive, and that was thousands of years ago. It's interesting because it is part of human heritage. And therefore, intrinsically interesting.
Get anything from it? Yes or no?
Yes, because yeah, it's part of human history and needs to be understood.
Okay, so we're joined on the line now by Alex Craner. Where are you, Alex? By the way, I hope you're there.
I'm in Monaco.
Brilliant.
The usual.
Okay, so you are a former hedge fund manager. You also, can we just maybe start by saying something a little bit about your book about the Magnitsky Act? And this is extremely significant because it's the beginnings, really, I think, in a big way, of the economic and financial firewall that was being put down between East and West, particularly between Russia and other European countries and Western countries generally. So can you just tell us a little bit about what made you what the title of the book is and what really got your goat enough to actually want to go and write that book?
Okay, first of all, Tony, good to join you again. Thank you for the invite, and I'm very, very happy to hear that you understood that the Magnitsky Act has nothing to do with human rights or any such other nonsense, but it's simply a legal and financial firewall between the West and Russia. Why? Because during the 1990s, during the so-called transition that Russia underwent from communism to capitalism, Western financial interests ran a veritable pirate raid against Russia, and they plundered billions of dollars in Russia's wealth. And so I, you know, through my, how do you call it, through my line of business, I never had any kind of investment in Russia. I never did any investing in Russia. I was always purely a commodities trader. But, you know, Russia is kind of relevant from the point of view that, you know, if there's harsh winter in Russia, it might affect oil prices. Russia is a large exporter of oil and gas and wheat and such things. So it's kind of relevant to keep on the radar through the news flow. So I came to know this man called Bill. His name is Bill Browder. I met him on two occasions in Monaco, and I knew that he ran the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia. The company was named Hermitage Capital Management. And at the time, he appeared like a normal fund manager investing in Russia. I met him first time in 2005, and he got my attention because he was the first person I ever heard say anything positive about Vladimir Putin. And this kind of got my attention because he was talking real things. You know, he wasn't talking that Vladimir Putin spoke languages and dressed nicely. He was saying, my company does deep investigations into corruption going on in Russia, and then we publish the results of our investigations in financial press. And every time Vladimir Putin's government comes in and cleans up, they change the laws, they close the loopholes, they fire the corrupt management. And he discovered a good business model this way, because they would acquire shares of Russian companies that were very, very undervalued due to corruption. Then they would expose the corruption. Vladimir Putin's government would clean up, and then the shares of the company would go up 5 times, 10 times, and so forth. So Bill Browder made a big fortune. And it wasn't the only game he was playing there. But what happens? 5 years later, in 2010, Bill Browder is in Monaco again, and this time the story is completely different. So this time he's speaking against Vladimir Putin. He's advising people not to invest one penny in Russia. And so he changed his tack 180 degrees. I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. What happened? Turns out he was kicked out of Russia over tax evasion. And in 2015, he published a book called Red Notice, which was my own conviction, ghostwritten by Lee Child. And it turned into like an international bestseller, because as far as spy thrillers go, it was a very well-written book. The problem is that it's fiction. Practically nothing in there is true. And then, you know, this was exactly the narrative that Bill Browder had used to lobby the Magnitsky legislation through the U.S. Congress in 2012. And the thing about Magnitsky legislation is, this was called Magnitsky Act of 2012. The thing about that legislation is that it is deemed to be the opening salvo of the new Cold War between Russia and the West. So this is where everything cooked up. And once I read Bill Browder's book, I understood that he wasn't just some hedge fund manager doing business in Russia. I understood that he was a part of a large international network that comprises top of the banking cartel and the intelligence agencies like MI6 and CIA. And among his banking partners were Edmond Safra, who died here in Monaco in 1999, and whose bank, Republic National Bank of New York, was then absorbed into HSBC, which is Bill Browder's current partner or employer or sponsor. I don't know which. And so Bill Browder from 2012 has turned into the world's most relentless and most prolific demonizer on Russia. He is the world's go-to expert on Vladimir Putin's corruption. And he has continued to lobby for this Magnitsky legislation, and he has been able to pass it in 30 different countries around the world. And as you correctly said, this is simply a firewall between Russian legal and financial system and that of the West, because they want to prevent Russians to investigate the plunder and the theft of Russian assets that has taken place during the 1990s. So, you know, having understood these things and having understood that this powerful network that Bill Browder was fronting from was pushing us straight into World War III, I thought somebody needs to expose this. Somebody needs to out these people. And then, you know, I thought, well, maybe I know a little bit more about this than your average person on the street. Yeah. So I thought, may as well be me. So that's how I decided to write that book, because I have lived once through the outbreak of war in former Yugoslavia. Yeah. I'm a Croatian national. Yeah. I know what happens when countries go to war. It's unthinkable. And I thought, I at the very least, I have to add my voice to, you know, to the anti-war cause and try to avert the slow but relentless sleepwalk into World War III. Yeah. So that's how my book came about. And then 5 years after I self-published it on Amazon, 5 weeks, right? Amazon canceled me. They canceled the book. They deleted it from their page, from their catalog. And the reason is because a man called Jonathan Weiner, who is, you know, the epitome of the deep state swamp creature from Washington, D.C. He used to be advisor to John Kerry when John Kerry was Secretary of State under Obama. And one letter from Jonathan Weiner to Amazon was enough to make my book disappeared. And then the book was republished by a proper publisher called Red Pill Press, who spent 9 months combing through the book to make sure that there's nothing there that they could get sued for. And then the book was banned again 6 weeks after it was published. So obviously, whatever's in that book, they're very keen that you don't learn about it.
Okay, well, just remind us of the title and where you can get it now.
It's the title is Grand Deception: The Truth About Magnitsky Act, the Truth About Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanctions. And it's available on the pages of Red Pill Press. That's redpillpress1word.com.
Okay. Well, bless you for doing all that, Alex. And, you know, a marvelous sentiment behind, you know, particularly someone that's lived through that whole horrific Yugoslav conflict.
Yes.
Anyway, we're going to go now and have a little listen to a certain Vladimir Putin speaking yesterday. Well, he spoke a few days ago, I think. But anyway, it was live last night. We were sitting at home, sort of half watching the BBC Question Time with a whole bunch of very boring panelists trotting through the same old usual rubbish and nonsense and being guided in their inanity by the chief presenter of the Antiques Roadshow, who somehow is now in charge of the BBC's flagship TV current affairs program. So just switched us watching the pictures, but we had in it going at the the sound from Tucker Carlson talking to Putin. One of the things he said in a very, very simple, basic way, Alex, was that we have no quarrel with the Americans whatsoever, but there are certain people in Washington, D.C. that are not our friends. And he was pointing out that actually Russia was part of the settling of Alaska. It was also part of it's quite a lot of historical stuff in there, and also the settling of Hawaii. But that these people in DC, Alex, are certainly not our friends, he said. So just tell us what you make of maybe you could. I'm going to play a clip in a minute, but what you make of this whole phenomenon of Tucker Carlson being over in Moscow.
I think that, well, it's wonderful. It was exactly last Saturday, so it was 6 days ago, that a friend called me up from Moscow. He said, like, oh, you're never going to guess who I had a chat with. It was Tucker Carlson. So I knew from Saturday morning that Tucker Carlson was in Moscow. And I was sure that he was there. He wouldn't say why he was there, but I was sure he was there to interview Vladimir Putin. And so now we know. And so I think that's absolutely wonderful. And you can tell by the reaction of the official dom in Europe and in the United States that they're going absolutely berserk about it. There's heads exploding. And, you know, every time these people are upset, I reckon something good has happened. And I think that the reason why this is very good is because it challenges their narrative control. You know, they are really, really keen on us not hearing from Vladimir Putin unfiltered in his own words, because they have been trying to cast him into a role of the boogeyman, the villain that we have to somehow get rid of since 2003. So ever since he slammed the Rothschild agent Mikhail Khodorkovsky in prison, the West has been very, very keen on getting rid of Putin. And so he's been cast into the role of the villain, and Western press has been relentlessly demonizing him practically every day since 2003, well, so going on 20 years.
Yeah, they certainly
and
have.
So if people hear Vladimir Putin in his own words, unfiltered, they might think, like, well, you know, actually he sounds quite reasonable and logical, and he doesn't seem like a villainous, murderous, evil person.
No,
and
anyway.
So, you know, that blows up a little bit the whole narrative of why we should be conscripting young men into the army and creating a new Eastern Front.
Yes,
and
yeah,
get everybody killed fighting Russia, you know?
Yeah, so now they're running out of Ukrainians. They've just called for another 500,000
yes,
Ukrainians to join the army, and they're not going to get them. So they're thinking,
yes,
of drafting young Brits, unemployed young Brits, into,
well,
the Ukrainian army.
Well, they are thinking
army.
Of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're clearly thinking about that. And I think that's extremely dangerous, Tony, because see, look what happened in Ukraine. And Ukrainians were not keen on fighting the war. You know, after the coup in 2014, during the first elections, the extreme right-wing parties, the Svoboda Party and the right sector, in total gained 1.6% of the popular vote. So they were very fringe and very unpopular. And even in 2019, after so many years of anti-Russian hysteria that was going through not only through Ukraine media, but also through the textbook of Ukrainian schools and universities and so forth, it was the nation was flooded with Russophobia, right? And even in 2019, the Ukrainian people swept Volodymyr Zelensky into power with a 73% vote. Why? Because he was promising peace with the Eastern breakaway republics. He was promising normalization of relationship with Russia, and he was promising re-legalization of the Russian language. So even in 2019, Ukrainian people were overwhelmingly in favor of peace. And today you see that as many as 500,000 of them are now dead. And you see the neo-Nazi thugs of the Ukrainian government sweeping up men, old men, young men, boys, off the street to shove them into the trenches on the Eastern Front. They have a 300 euro incentive for everybody, every warm body they can get to the front. And so, you know, this is a lesson for us, because once this process gets going, you know, once they get the war emergency going, once they start creating the war psychosis at home, the polarization increases, and the state apparatus that wants to perpetuate the war grows stronger and grows more unscrupulous, and, you know, if we're not careful, if we don't say no, if we don't say stop now, we're not interested in this, it might be our children who are going, yeah, to be swept off the streets to shove into the trenches on the Eastern Front.
Yes, I think you're
when
right.
When you see,
yeah,
the photographs from Ukraine, with thousands of Ukrainian flags over graves of young Ukrainian men, this should be a warning to us all. Let's not mess around with this. Let's stop this in its track now.
Yeah, because in a way, you know, what we'll be looking at is, you know, what you witnessed in Yugoslavia on a massive international scale, potentially. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the interview itself. And I think one of the issues absolutely at the heart of all of this is this Ukrainian Nazi faction, which has been fostered by the United States, actually, and possibly by other NATO countries ever since World War II. So Tucker Carlson broached this topic.
You say Hitler has been dead for so many years, 80 years, but his example lives on. People who exterminated Jews, Russians, and Poles are alive. And the president, the current president of today's Ukraine, applauds him in the Canadian Parliament, gives a standing ovation. Can we say that we have completely uprooted this ideology if what we see is happening today? That is what the Nazification is in our understanding. We have to get rid of those people who maintain this concept and support this practice and try to preserve it. That is what denazification is. That is what we mean.
Right. My question was a little more specific. It was, of course, not a defense of Nazis, neo or otherwise. It was a practical question. You don't control the entire country. You don't control Kiev. You don't seem like you want to. So how do you eliminate a culture or an ideology or feelings or a view of history in a country that you don't control? What do you do about that?
You
know, as strange as it may seem to you, during the negotiations in Istanbul, we did agree that we have it all in writing. Neo-Nazism would not be cultivated in Ukraine, including that it would be prohibited at the legislative level. Mr. Carson, we agreed on that. This, it turns out, can be done during the negotiation process. And there's nothing humiliating for Ukraine as a modern civilized state. Is any state allowed to promote Nazism? It is not, is it? That is it.
Will there be talks, and why haven't there been talks, about resolving the conflict in Ukraine? Peace talks.
They have been. They reached a very high stage of coordination of positions in a complex process, but still they were almost finalized. But after we withdrew our troops from Kiev, as I have already said, the other side threw away all these agreements and obeyed the instructions of Western countries, European countries, and the United States to fight Russia to the bitter end. Moreover, the president of Ukraine has legislated a ban on negotiating with Russia. He signed a decree forbidding everyone to negotiate with Russia. But how are we going to negotiate if he forbade himself and everyone to do this? We know that he is putting forward some ideas about the settlement, but in order to agree on something, we need to have a dialogue. Is that not right?
Well, but you wouldn't be speaking to the Ukrainian president, you'd be speaking to the American president. When was the last time you spoke to Joe Biden?
I cannot remember when I talked to him. I do not remember. We can look it up.
You don't remember?
No. Why? Do I have to remember everything? I have my own things to do. We have domestic political affairs.
Well, he's funding the war that you're fighting, so I would think that would be memorable.
Well, yes, he funds, but I talked to him before the special military operation, of course. And I said to him then, by the way, I will not go into details, I never do, but I said to him then, I believe that you are making a huge mistake of historic proportions by supporting everything that is happening there, in Ukraine, by pushing Russia away. I told him repeatedly, by the way. I think that would be correct if I stop here.
What did he say?
Ask him, please. It is easier for you. You are a citizen of the United States. Go and ask him. It is not appropriate for me to comment on our conversation.
But you haven't spoken to him since before February of 2022.
No, we haven't spoken. Certain contacts are being maintained, though. Speaking of which, do you remember what I told you about my proposal to work together on a missile defense system?
Yes.
You can ask all of them. All of them are safe and sound, thank God. The former president, Condoleezza, is safe and sound, and I think Mr. Gates and the current director of the intelligence agency, Mr. Burns, the then ambassador to Russia, in my opinion, are very successful ambassador. They were all witnesses to these conversations. Ask them. Same here. If you are interested in what Mr. President Biden responded to me, ask him. At any rate, I talked to him about it.
I'm definitely interested, but from the outside, it seems like this could devolve or evolve into something that brings the entire world into conflict and could initiate a nuclear launch. And so why don't you just call Biden and say, let's work this out?
What's there to work out? It's very simple. I repeat, we have contacts through various agencies. I will tell you what we are saying on this matter and what we are conveying to the U.S. leadership. If you really want to stop fighting, you need to stop supplying weapons. It will be over within a few weeks. That's it. And then we can agree on some terms. Before you do that, stop. What's easier? Why would I call him? What should I talk to him about? Or beg him for what?
And what messages do you get back?
You're going to deliver such and such weapons to Ukraine? Oh, I'm afraid, please don't. What is there to talk about?
Do you think NATO is worried about this becoming a global war or a nuclear conflict?
At least that's what they're talking about. And they're trying to intimidate their own population with an imaginary Russian threat. This is an obvious fact. And thinking people, not Philistines, but thinking people, analysts, those who are engaged in real politics, just smart people, understand perfectly well that this is a fake. They're trying to fuel the Russian threat.
So that's Tucker Carlson interviewing Russian President Vladimir Putin, broadcast on X and various other platforms yesterday evening. I think I watched it on VK.com, which is a kind of Russian version of Facebook. But Alex, what did you make of the interview? Is anything that's either there or any other things you heard that stood out to you? I remember also another thing he talks about. He goes into some real detail about how Boris Johnson flew over whilst he was British Prime Minister to stop the peace talks, basically to persuade or strong arm Zelensky into simply walking away from those peace talks when the Russians had literally just pulled out of Kiev. From away from the area, it looked as if everything was going to calm down. There was going to be peace back in 2022.
Yes, and that's a very, very important moment in the war, because the Russians, when they initiated the special military operation nearly 2 years ago, the Russians almost immediately started to have talks with Kiev, with the Ukrainian government, and these talks over the next 3 weeks. Reached a very important milestone. They formulated a peace plan. It was initialed. It was ready to be signed, and it was mediated by the Turks. And then, it's true, Boris Johnson flew unannounced into Kiev to persuade Vladimir Zelensky to renege, to walk away from the deal, and to fight the war, because, you know, the West is fully behind them. They're going to get everything they need. They're going to beat Russia militarily and so forth. And so that's what happened. You know, that's how the next 500,000 Ukrainian people died, and Ukraine ended up completely devastated and destroyed. But at that point, Vladimir Putin had no territorial demands whatsoever. So he wasn't about to give back Crimea. but the Donbas was going to remain in as part of Ukraine. And he demanded that Ukraine be neutral, that they commit to not joining the NATO, and that Russia was going to completely pull out its troops from Ukraine altogether. And as a gesture of goodwill to show that they mean that, they pulled the troops away from Kiev. So there was no Battle of Kiev, like they tell us in the news. The Russians simply withdrew from Kiev to say, we're committed to this peace plan, and here we're pulling our troops away from Kiev. That was on Boris Johnson. Whoever sent him there, you know, in the media, they say that Biden sent him there, but I don't know why Biden would send him there. He has Blinken, he has Nuland, he has an ambassador in Kiev, he has dozens of CIA officers in Kiev. Anybody could have done it. Why Johnson went there, that's what the British people need to be asking, because this was a very, very nefarious act on his part.
Well, let's ask Martin. Martin, who do you think may have sent him?
Well, I think he will have been...
MI6? Chatham House?
He will have been keen to don't forget his position inside British politics was extremely precarious at this point, and he's a notoriously egotistical and narcissistic personality. So the idea of him going to read the riot
Who
act
sent
to Zelensky,
him? Who sent him?
I'm coming to that. I think that he would certainly not have gone without the agreement of the American leadership, and it's not necessarily Biden, because Biden isn't even the American leader, is he? I mean, is he in charge? I think most people think he isn't.
Who is at the apex of this Anglo-Zionist empire here? They are the people that sent him, aren't they?
Well, I would agree they are, but you wouldn't necessarily... I mean, you know, why would I know the exact names of those people?
But I'm not asking...
State in the US.
Give us a hand, anyway. Come on, Martin. I say MI6. What do you say?
Well, MI6 have played a very nefarious role in all of this. The Russians certainly perceive them as being more belligerent than the Americans.
Okay, Alex.
Can I ask a question, gentlemen? Maybe you know the answer to this. At the outset of war in Ukraine, allegedly, there was a letter drafted by Nathaniel Rothschild to British MPs urging them to come to the aid of Ukraine, to help arm Ukraine, to help fight the war, blah, 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 all these things. Are you guys aware of this letter, and do you know whether it's a real letter or whether this is a hoax?
I certainly don't. I certainly remember reading that this was a close... Hang on. I think there's a Reuters thing saying fabricated letter about Ukraine and Putin attributed to Nat Rothschild. That was March 2022 on Reuters. But then, of course, these things can be fact-checked out of existence, even though they're real. So nothing deceives a document. So we don't really know.
I don't know either, so I put my hand up.
You know, if we talk about who's at the top of the pyramid, you know, there is that wonderful photograph of Jacob Rothschild standing next to Boris Johnson in front of his manor, not Boris Johnson's manor, the Jacob Rothschild's manor, right? He's the one with the money. And, you know, as Napoleon Bonaparte said, when the politicians are dependent on bankers for money, it is the bankers who formulate the policy, not the politicians. So there, I'll leave it there. And maybe, you know, maybe people can reach their own conclusion.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I'll put a link up to the some evidence, if there is any, of this being real, this. But then it's the sort of thing that might be deliberately fabricated as a kind of straw man argument that can then be torn down,
well,
Alex.
You know, but it's a straw man argument. There hasn't been an argument about this. It just vanished. So it hasn't been an argument, and I haven't heard anybody trying to trace the command and control hierarchy to those levels. So if it was meant to be a straw man or a red herring, it was completely ineffective. It just disappeared.
So, I mean, surely Jacob Rothschild is a banker. Nat Rothschild is his son, I think, isn't he? Who was at Oxford in the Bullingdon Club with David Cameron, with, who else was it? George Osborne, a whole load of other people. Boris Johnson.
Radek Sikorsky.
Boris Johnson.
yeah, Radek Sikorsky was Boris Johnson's friend, and Radek Sikorsky is eyeballs deep into Ukraine's coup, in organization of Ukraine's coup in 2014, and he's currently the foreign minister of Poland. So, you know, he became the British subject, he became member of the Bullingdon Club, recruited by Boris Johnson into the Bullingdon Club. And then practically as soon as he was done with Oxford, he went back to Poland, got his Polish citizenship back, and his political career took off like a rocket. Yeah. So, you know, lots of dots to join up there.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thanks for starting that little discussion. But look, we're going to have another clip now, not so long this time. But this is where Tucker Carlson asked Vladimir Putin a bit about AI and Elon Musk, and also about Evan Dershowitz, who's in a Russian prison, I believe is a US journalist.
Mankind is currently facing many threats. Due to the genetic researches, it is now possible to create a superhuman, a specialized human being, a genetically engineered athlete, scientist, military man. There are reports that Elon Musk has already had a chip implanted in the human brain in the USA.
What do you think of that?
Well, I think there's no stopping Elon Musk. He will do as he sees fit. Nevertheless, you need to find some common ground with him. Search for ways to persuade him. I think he's a smart person. I truly believe he is. So you need to reach an agreement with him, because this process needs to be formalized and subjected to certain rules. Humanity has to consider what is going to happen due to the newest development in genetics or in AI. One can make an approximate prediction of what will happen. Once mankind felt an existential threat coming from nuclear weapons, all nuclear nations began to come to terms with one another, since they realized the negligent use of nuclear weaponry could drive humanity to extinction. It is impossible to stop research in genetics or AI today, just as it was impossible to stop the use of gunpowder back in the day. But as soon as we realize that the threat comes from unbridled and uncontrolled development of AI, or genetics, or any other field, the time will come to reach an international agreement on how to regulate these things.
I appreciate all the time you've given us. I just got to ask you one last question, and that's about someone who's very famous in the United States, probably not here. Evan Gershkovitz, who's the Wall Street Journal reporter. He's 32, and he's been in prison for almost a year. This is a huge story in the United States, and I just want to ask you directly, without getting into the details of it or your version of what happened, if as a sign of your decency, you would be willing to release him to us and we'll bring him back to the United States.
We have done so many gestures of goodwill out of decency that I think we have run out of them. We have never seen anyone reciprocate to us in a similar manner. However, in theory, we can say that we do not rule out that we can do that, if our partners take reciprocal steps. When I talk about the partners, I first of all refer to special services. Special services are in contact with one another. They are talking about the matter in question. There is no taboo to settle this issue. We are willing to solve it. But there are certain terms being discussed via special services channels. I believe an agreement can be reached.
Yeah, so that's another clip. Maybe you could just tell us what you make of those two particular issues. I think it was quite wonderful to see Tucker putting it on him, you know, a surprise question, which seemed to kind of slightly destabilise Putin, saying, look, just hand this guy over to us. We can go home with him, you know, the journalist. And also, of course, looking at this incredible subject of AI, which is Putin quite rightly is comparing to the idea of trying to uninvent gunpowder, Alex.
Well, you know, with regards to AI, I have to try to demystify it a little bit because I have spent a good chunk of my life in AI development. I managed an AI development program for many years, and so I'm familiar with the concept down to the ones and zeros. AI can be a wonderful thing, but it is a very, very difficult thing. It's very challenging, and it's only as good as the way you design it and build it and maintain it. We have to separate this from what we think we understood through science fiction movies. You know, don't imagine that we're going to have a Skynet and Terminators killing people around and doing whatnot. Any AI system, any software system can only function according to very narrow specifications. It's designed around specific requirements. It can do very specific things. It can never, it doesn't possess its own intelligence, right? It only has a knowledge base, and it only has a large amount of data that it can reference between this what it receives from the outside world and what is it in its knowledge base, so that it can discern patterns, and that it can interpret things like words, sentences, objects, and so forth.
Yeah, well, so I've had similar thoughts, or not just my thoughts, but yeah, from top people in the journalist union over the years, chatting to them about this, saying, well, really, AI doesn't exist, and really what it is, it's an excuse for, yes, for if a system is programmed, say, for example, to kill people, which allegedly it has been used in Ukraine, and in Libya, places like that, to kill people, you know, linking up satellites with weapon systems and then just saying, well, go and kill what you want, basically. So the idea is to try and personalize it in order to excuse the people who are relinquishing any responsibility over the deaths that they're causing using such a system. Yes. Anyway, so I don't think, yeah, I think...
You know, there's a lot of psyops patched over all of these stories, you know, because they... You know, military powers try to make themselves look more sophisticated and more powerful than they really are. So they like to flaunt weapons, that imaginary weapons that they don't really have. And so this could be the case of this. But I can tell you a story when, you know, the United States had this drone assassination program. And they had a massive challenge because it turned out that the pilots didn't like killing people they didn't know for reasons that they didn't understand. And so they had a massive turnover of the pilots. And then Google stepped in and launched this Operation Maven with the Pentagon, where they were going to create AI tools and programs to replace these pilots so that AI could go around killing people from drones. Well, guess what? There was like a rebellion at Google. Like their top engineers quit, and 4,000 Google employees signed a petition saying, like, we want you to discontinue Project Maven, and we want you to not work with the U.S. Defense Department. And then the Tech Workers Association of America, something like this, made a bigger petition, more people, that they demanded not just Google, but also IBM and Amazon and some other large tech firms to not work with the U.S. Defense Department, to not weaponize software technology. And so, you know, you also have the problem of people's willingness to create those systems. And those system, believe me, those systems do not maintain themselves. It is enough for a software programmer not to properly document the code that they're writing, and very likely the next software developer who takes the charge of the service will have no idea what they're dealing with.
Yeah, so you know, what's your assessment of the extent to which this has been deployed? I mean, I remember reading last, I think it was 2022 Christmas in the Times, about the Palantir system being tested as a form of, well, they called it AI, but really we're talking here just about a computerized kill system in eastern Ukraine being deployed by the United States and the Ukrainians.
Yes, I don't know what it is. I really don't know what it is, but I think it shouldn't be called AI. It should probably be called technological software-based tools for killing people, you know. So instead of having a person doing that, you have a computer with a sensor with it's not really AI. It's not like Skynet, some robot takes off like Arnold Schwarzenegger and then pursues Sarah Connor forever and is unstoppable. There's nothing like that. This is just like a computerized, advanced, satellite-based, sensor-based, software-based, means of killing, which is just an alternative to a trained assassin going to kill somebody. There's no greater mystery to it than that.
Okay, well, I think one of the most interesting questions Tucker asked Putin this week was about the non-violent. He was saying, look, hang on, you're supposed to be a Orthodox Christian country. How do you square that with this non-violent approach of Christ? You know, this turn the other cheek kind of thing. Then he also asked him a really, I thought, brilliant question about, do you believe in the supernatural? Do you believe that God intervenes?
Christianity is specifically a non-violent religion. Jesus says, turn the other cheek, don't kill. How can a leader who has to kill of any country, how can a leader be a Christian? How do you reconcile that to yourself?
It is very easy when it comes to protecting oneself and one's family, one's homeland. We won't attack anyone. When did the developments in Ukraine start? Since the coup d'etat and the hostilities in Donbas begun, that's when they started. And we're protecting our people, ourselves, our homeland, and our future. As for religion in general, you know, it's not about external manifestations. It's not about going to church every day or banging your head on the floor. It is in the heart. And our culture is so human-oriented. Dostoevsky, who was very well known in the West and the genius of Russian culture, Russian literature, spoke a lot about this, about the Russian soul. After all, Western society is more pragmatic. Russian people think more about the eternal, about moral values. I don't know, maybe you won't agree with me, but Western culture is more pragmatic after all. I'm not saying this is bad. It makes it possible for today's golden billion to achieve good success in production, even in science and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that we kind of look the same, but our minds are
built. So do you see the supernatural at work as you look out across what's happening in the world now? Do you see God at work? Do you ever think to yourself, these are forces that are not human?
No, to be honest, I don't think so. My opinion is that the development of the world community is in accordance with the inherent laws, and those laws are what they are. It's always been this way in the history of mankind. Some nations and countries rose, became stronger and more numerous, and then left the international stage, losing the status they had accustomed to. There's probably no need for me to give examples, but we could start with the Genghis Khan and horde conquerors, the Golden Horde, and then end with the Roman Empire. It seems that there has never been anything like the Roman Empire in the history of mankind. Nevertheless, the potential of the barbarians gradually grew, as did their population. In general, the barbarians were getting stronger and began to develop economically, as we would say today. This eventually led to the collapse of the Roman Empire and the regime imposed by the Romans. However, it took 5 centuries for the Roman Empire to fall apart. The difference with what is happening now is that all the processes of change are happening at a much faster pace than in Roman times.
Yeah, not half. Alex, what do you make of that? You know, he's talking there particularly about the sort of spiritual side of this, the Russian soul, and also this idea of, well, I don't expect God to come in and help us, but he's maybe somewhere hanging around, and he's certainly giving us the morals behind what we do.
Well, I think that Tucker Carlson's question here was a little bit awkward, or maybe he should have formulated it a little bit better, because, you know, it's obvious that, well, you know, take Christianity in Europe, for example. European civilization has wiped out 6 major civilizations around the world. You know, the Mayas, the Aztecas, the Incas, Indian, Chinese, Japanese civilization, and we are Christians, right? So, you know, this sudden idea that Christianity is a religion of peace, well, fine, fair enough, but we haven't been very good conducting.
Hang on, Alex, because there's layers of this, aren't there? I mean, Bush and Blair both declared themselves to be Christians. I don't think anyone believes they were.
Yeah, well, you know, Hitler was a Catholic. Heinrich Himmler was a Catholic. You know, we can, you know, the list is very, very, very long. Francisco Franco was a Catholic. He shot a man in his face with his own gun. So, you know, I think.
But I mean,
he's making
a good point, I think, about the Orthodox. He's trying to say the Orthodox tradition is very different to the Catholic, to the Protestant. We have a different tradition here, and he's obviously nailing his colors to that mast.
Yes, sure, fair enough. But, you know, I think that that question didn't contribute anything. And then, you know, if you want to go into deep into Christianity and Christian eschatology, you know, we ultimately at some level believe in the second coming of Christ. And we know that the second coming of Christ, Christ announced that when he returns, he will not come back as a pious religious leader. He will come to wage war and judge. That's the, you know, that's the eschatology. And so I don't see the contradiction, but I also don't see a lot of relevance in that question. I don't think we gained anything much by him asking him that question. I thought he could have used the time a little bit better.
What do you think is going to be, you know, how's this going to go, the conflict in Ukraine? It's at a bit of a stalemate, as we heard in the first clip.
It's not remotely at a stalemate. Ukraine's getting pummeled.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's not going anywhere right now. They're trying to get more troops on the Ukrainian side. The Russians have really kind of won. But there is always the potential. This is a bit like the whole situation in the Donbass. It's bubbling away. It's fermenting there, and it's a potential flashpoint, just as the Middle East is, but particularly focusing on Ukraine. Where do you think it's heading?
It's heading for Ukraine's total defeat and Russia imposing its terms of armistice. And, you know, the idea of stalemate, like it's not moving anywhere. Westerners easily fall into this error because they think that progress means change in the shape of the map. You know, that the colors on the map have got to be moving. Remember, For weeks now, Ukrainians have been losing an average of 1,200 soldiers a day. They have no troops left. They're running out of troops. They're running out of munitions. It's game over. These are the last bangs of the agony of Ukraine, and it's coming very close to an end. So I think it ends in an armistice where Russia is going to dictate the terms of peace. It's going to be an utter catastrophe for Western powers, not necessarily for people in the West, you know, not for you and me necessarily, but for the entrenched establishment in London, in Brussels, in Paris, in Berlin, and so forth. It's going to be a catastrophe for them. It's going to be a catastrophe for the European and American financial system, because they're going to lose last hope of securing the collateral that is, you know, Eastern Russia, and their hope of securing Russian proper. Oh, no, sorry, not Eastern Russia, Eastern Ukraine, and the collateral of Russia proper. And so it's going to be an epic defeat for the West.
Also, I think it'd be useful to hear your views on whether you think there's any connection between the, and if so, what it is, between the genocide going on in Gaza and in the Ukraine conflict.
I do believe so, actually, Tony, because I am one of those people who's convinced that 7 October was a false flag operation. Now, you know, people jump on this because they think I'm implying that the Israeli leadership orchestrated it. That's not how false flag operations work. Usually you have a very small group within the intelligence agencies who orchestrate this, and they basically ambush the political leadership into taking some kind of an action. And I think that the hope here was that if you're losing one war, you open another one, you try to destabilize another region, because you're hoping that amidst the chaos, you're going to somehow be able to weaken your rivals and somehow squeeze out some kind of a geopolitical victory for yourself. I think it didn't work, but it did result with an awful lot of bloodshed in Gaza. And I think, I personally think that Israel has inflicted a death wound on itself.
You may be right. Yeah, let's just have a listen to, quickly, a short clip from Al Jazeera. I think this is Al Jazeera, discussing the visit by Blinken and Netanyahu doubling down.
Less than a day after Hamas submitted its response to a potential Gaza ceasefire plan, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Israel, hoping to build on that momentum. But hours after meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel all but rejected the current framework for a cessation of hostilities.
Now is the time for the Israeli Defense Forces to allow safe corridors for the residents of Rafah. We shall continue destroying the capabilities of Hamas until we achieve that. And I emphasize, we have no other option but decisive victory.
Yeah, no option, apparently, Alex.
Yes, well, you know, if your only option is wishful thinking, then you're already lost.
Yeah, I think what's happened here is they've bitten off more than they can chew. I agree with you, it probably was a false flag and let it happen on purpose, because it looks as if they'd infiltrated Hamas enough to know what was going on. And even in the Israeli press, there's various questions being asked about what happened on the day. You know, why were so many people not where they were supposed to be, for example. But that doesn't mean that when you've done your false flag, whether it's 9/11 or what happened on October the 7th, that you then can control the consequences of your actions. And what they've done, yes, to my mind, is they've actually brought the question of the existence of the State of Israel straight back to the international agenda where it was in the 1940s. Up to now, everybody's been talking, and even the Russians are still talking about there's going to have to be, and the Saudis and so on, there's going to have to be a settlement, two-state solution based on the 67 borders and Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital. But that what they've done is they've blown that all out of the water, and it now becomes the existence of the State of Israel, just as the existence of Al-Jalif al-Say in the 1950s, the settlers from France had been dominating Algeria for 120 years, but they all, in the end, had to go home. And the Israelis have now backed themselves into that corner, and they're not militarily capable of defending. They're because of, you've got the Russian Air Force in Syria. You've got the changes of tactics. I mean, look at the way that Hezbollah are using drones and so on, just like in the Ukraine. Israeli military superiority is disintegrating. And, of course, they've actually got a very small state. It's a country the size of probably smaller than Croatia.
Final question, Alex. We've got news yesterday of more, another round of strikes against the Yemenis. They keep calling him an Nasrullah or the Houthis or whatever, but actually this is really the government of Yemen. We're talking about the US and Britain declaring war on. Is that going to go anywhere? And how? And where do you think this conflict in the Middle East is you know, which direction are we heading? It doesn't seem to me as if it's having much effect.
Yeah, I don't think it's having any very much effect, and I can't really understand why U.S. and Britain are doing it, other than maybe because the military-industrial complex has to replace all those bombs, so, you know, somebody's making a ton of money. But there is no strategy. You know, Houthis have withstood 8 years of bombardment with American bombs and American technology and American coordination by the Saudis. It didn't achieve anything. You know, there's already in the early 1990s, several documents came out of the, you know, of the Pentagon, from the Pentagon and some American think tanks, where basically they understood that their hold on the Middle East is very much in jeopardy, and that the two pillars of their hegemony in the Middle East were a projection of power, so not power itself, projection of power, and B, their alliances. So using allies to keep the region stable. And the projection of power part means that, you know, they have to look mean and huff and puff around and scare everybody into compliance, because if they actually go to war, their weakness is going to show up. So it's preferable to have Saudis go to war, to have Jordanians go to war, and whoever. And so now both of those pillars are kind of crumbling, you know, because their military power is showing to be ineffective, and their alliances are unraveling. You know, nobody wants to go along with this anymore. I mean, you know, maybe Jordan is the last holdout, but even Jordan is now being shaken down by public protests and revolts. So I think that the end of the story is that the empire is going to have to leave the region with its tail tucked between its legs.
Okay, well, just remind us of your how to follow you, best places to look for you online.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I can be found easily on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy, and I write a Substack which is called Alex Craner's Trend Compass. Yeah, and so that should be easy to find. And from there's links to other platforms.
And for real hardcore listeners, just remind us of the title of the book at Red Pill Press again.
Yes, it's called The Grand Deception: The Truth About Bill Browder, Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanctions.
Okay, Alex Craner from Monaco, thanks ever so much for joining us once more.
Thank you.
Our final item this week, Martin, is David Halpin, who I asked this week about the cancer diagnosis of the king, and asked him particularly about what was going on with this enlarged prostate op, and also what any kind of examination of him might have, in what way might that have discovered what kind of cancer? Because we've been really told very little about this, but David Halpin, it seems to me, is the guy to ask.
I heard that he was going into a London hospital because he had a prostate problem, and I imagine that he had what we call prostatic hyperplasia. That means excess growth. It doesn't imply cancer, and the commonest cause is benign hyperplasia. And this causes men to get up at night for pee, have more difficulty peeing, the stream lessens. Instead of being able to hit the wall with your stream, it tends to dribble, and you get dribbling at the end of the stream as well. You can diagnose that from the history, and then you do the next thing. You ask the patient, having told them what you're going to do, of course, to lie upon the couch with their knees flexed up by their chest, and you put your finger inside a latex glove with some KY jelly into the rectum. And you can then feel the prostate in the front of the rectum. And you can feel the prostate quite easily. It's a very important examination. There was a little saying that if you don't put your finger in, you put your foot in it. And that when you put your finger in, you can feel the prostate through the wall of the rectum. And if it's round and smooth, you know it's likely to be benign. If it's craggy, then it's more likely to be cancer. And prostate cancer is an odd thing. There's a whole range of them, from what we call cancer in situ, where there's just a few cells scattered in the tissue, to when the whole organ is, in fact, has become cancerous or is being invaded more widely. But so we would imagine that King Charles III, if he was being looked after by a decent doctor, but they might have been a bit tentative, perhaps, about putting their finger into the queen, into the king's rectum, but we will imagine that when he presented with his urinary difficulty, he then had a rectal examination, a per-rectal examination of his prostate. They'd also examine his penis, his testicles, and they do a general examination if they're proper doctors. They examine his tummy, and after taking a first-class history, tell me, sir, I think I would say, tell me, sir, what's troubling you? And you'd hear the whole history, and that, this is a very important, Tony, that gives you the diagnosis in two-thirds of cases without examining the patient. So, going back to examination after the good history, we might have established that the King Charles III had benign prostatic hyperplasia, that we had, that's right, and that the prostate was enlarged, and his symptoms were severe enough to progress towards a cystoscopy, examination of the bladder with a cystoscope, and whilst under anaesthetic, although you don't require that for cystoscopy, you can use local anaesthetic gel. Whilst under anaesthetic, you would examine the prostate again in the operating theatre, I believe. I did a very good urology job in Southmead Hospital in Bristol, in the best urology firm in the country, where Mitchell, one of the surgeons, had invented the resectoscope, which I'm now going to speak about. If the King's symptoms were significant enough to require removal of the enlarged prostate, then they would have inserted Mitchell's resectoscope, or a modern equivalent, with an extra powerful made by Storz, and using a high-frequency radio signal through the little loop at the end of a resectoscope, which burns the tissue in a very local way, then the surgeon then takes out chips with the resectoscope and gradually removes the prostate in its mass via the urethra, via the penis. You understand? And every now and again, you take the scope out and you flush out the chips from the bladder. And then you go back in until you've removed as much tissue as is required. It's a skilled operation, a very skilled operation, but modern urologists will be very familiar with it. And when I go back to 1967, when I was working at Southmead with Mr. Slade and Roberts and Mitchell and Ashton Miller, he was another leader in Bristol, those men used to come in with retention of urine. They couldn't pee at all. They had to catheterize them. Now and again, some of them were very constipated. Most of them just had benign prostatic hyperplasia. As a junior doctor, we'd put in the catheter under sterile precautions. They'd go to the next operating list. They'd have an anesthetic, an epidural anesthetic by a wonderfully skilled anesthetist there. I can remember their names now. And one of those surgeons would resect the prostate in those old chaps, and they'd be going home about 4 days later from a ward which was entirely devoted to urology of men and women.
That's Dr. David Halpin, and the full version of that will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. But interesting to hear that the sort of cancer that might have been discovered on the prostate examination was potentially a rectal cancer. But then that doesn't quite make sense, because apparently there's a program of treatment, and that rectal cancer that David is talking about there would be just basically an operation. So who knows? But we are allowed to speculate, folks. We are, especially when we're not told. And so we've got a poem on the topic from finally tonight from Patricia Opulenza. Again, thank you, Patricia. Charlie not well. The rumour has spread. Perhaps he will sleep. He will keep now some time to his bed. An angle for sympathy, perhaps now a ploy. Narcissists often these tactics employ. Camilla, his trousers, is said now to wear. The boss of old Charlie, who's often seen tear his sycophants down, all running to please a man who be king, all bend at the knees. Acquisition of Seagen with Pfizer, now see. Jabs being made to cure the big C. Fast-growing cancers, now the public attack. No word of the cause, but a cure is their tack. Willy Bonkers in shadows being primed as we speak to continue bloodlines, Weffy Willy the weak. A family whose wealth seen hanging on tight, PR on steroids, defending their plight, living it large while our people can't pay for food or their bills or have a house where to stay. The blurb churned out daily, BS, what a spiel, a party of pity for their plight forced to feel. While our people for treatment for years all must wait. Quick treatment for Charlie and also for Kate. Harry jets in to hell, CO2. On tap, drama-rama. What a to-do. Husband snatcher Camilla over Charlie now lords. Whimpering words, his acts. No, applaud. Bangs full of cash. Land to the fill. Silencing those who refuse to do his will. Yes, Charlie is poorly, the rumour. Sachets. No care for our sovereignty or for the loot we all pay to defend us, befriend us, make sure and take care of the people who allow his life top of stairs. Instead, seems his loyalty for dark shadows who diss our freedoms, our choices to live as we wish. Watch karma come knocking to teach lessons abound that no pockets in shrouds shall ever be found. Thank you again, Patricia, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to Joe Banks, a freelance journalist from Bristol here, to Axe Craner from Monaco, joining us as well as Dr. David Miller, and also sound engineer Dave Bazenko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links and comment page, as well as, of course, on the app, the updated app nowadays. I might even find it easy to update. I'm not sure. I haven't done mine yet, but our email addresses, you can find them too on the show page, and I think actually they're on the app from memory. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Shadow ban, maybe, who knows? We're not allowed to know that sort of thing, are we? But we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. You can also get the weekly newsletter. If you email me, I'll add you to the list. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Deliver me. The crystal ship is being filled. A thousand girls, a thousand thrills, a million ways to spend your time. When we get back, I'll jump up.
When the truth is found to be